Hello, welcome to a first half of 2010 retrospective extravaganza brought to you by the Beamcast crew from ShonenBeam.com. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
And we're going to be taking a look at all the different series that we cover here on Beamcast regularly every Monday. And we're going to start off with One Piece, which the chapters we're covering are 569 through 589, beginning at the beginning of the year, where we were in the midst of the war arc between the Whitebeard Pirates and the world government. So just initial thoughts on where the action was right when we pick up on January 1st.
It was just a sea battle on an epic scale initially. You saw the Whitebeard Pirates with trying to save Luffy's brother Ace as a focus, basically going after the execution guard of the world government. And you saw a lot of epic fights, a lot of stuff going on in the background. Not really characters breaking up and fighting so much as whole platoons of characters going head-to-head against each other.
Mm-hmm. Clint, what were you thinking about just the general action in the war arc?
The war arc was great, and right where we're picking up at the beginning of the year is a pretty important part of it. Just all of the war arc is pretty important, I guess. There's a lot of things going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of individual fights going on during all of this. One of them was Luffy versus Kobe. Rather brief. I think it took place within one chapter, but it was notable because it kept the Kobe character around. Do we see Kobe as a major player down the road?
Yeah, I definitely think he's got some character development ahead of him, so hopefully he can stand on a more even ground with Luffy, which he certainly wasn't on at this point.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on him, Drew?
Well, Kobe, as a character who's been introduced very early, makes almost a lot of sense as a rival for Luffy, the same way Smoker was for an early part of the series.
Right. Okay. There's a moment when Luffy, I mean, obviously the entire point of this whole war arc from Luffy's standpoint was to chase after Ace and free him from execution, and there's a moment when he is about to be executed when Luffy uses this King's Haki. He yells for it to be stopped. He yells, "Stop it." And everyone freezes or collapses, and only those who are really battle-hardened that we recognize as powerful characters in this universe are able to stay conscious, even. We have some mixed feelings on Haki as a concept in general. How do we feel about this idea that Luffy has the Haoshoku Haki, the king's powerful Haki?
I like it. I think it adds depth to his character. I'm not dying to see the series just start revolving around Haki, which I don't think will happen. But he definitely needs something to keep up with other characters in the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Haki is an interesting take on Luffy's powers and a way to add to them without eating a second devil fruit, which can't do.
Well, yeah, you can't eat one, apparently, but we'll get to that in a moment. There were some other notable moments throughout here, just some general fun action. There was the scene when Luffy frees Ace from his handcuffs, and they're standing back-to-back and each fighting their own share of Marines. There's the really great scene where Squardo betrays Whitebeard, you know, stabs him with a sword in the back, and then that kind of transitions right into this scene of Whitebeard being fatherly, really forgiving him for his misguided ways, almost. How do you feel about the character portrayal there of Whitebeard?
Whitebeard is just an ultimate badass and a father to his men, sort of. And that scene starts to exemplify it. You get more of it later, but you certainly see that he's not one to be trifled with, and he's not one to abandon his principles.
Yeah, I just think Whitebeard is a really good character in that sense. He's just shown to be as much of a father to the crew as you would expect from anyone with that kind of status.
Right. Now, obviously, the major impact moment of the year in One Piece happened shortly thereafter, which was the death of Portugas de Ace, which at the time I claimed was the single most important shonen manga chapter in the next 10 years, just for the possibilities that it opens up for storyline purposes, because One Piece has always fallen under the stigma of being a kiddie show, a kiddie series, because no one dies. And this has really effectively put that to rest, not just because someone died, but A, because it was someone so important, and B, because you can now say, well, the reason why no one died up till that point is because that makes that death that much more impactful. What are your feelings on the death of Ace?
In many ways, it was a worth-the-wait moment. You see that, as Ace was introduced as a character, maybe not given as much development as the main cast and crew, he's definitely significant enough, and the build-up to that and the build-up of having no one die outside of flashbacks up to this point really just starts out as a sense of disbelief when you finally see Ace die, which I think more accurately mimics how we're actually supposed to mourn for a character when they do die. So it was a very well-executed death scene, as it were.
Clint?
I thought the specific panel that the scene occurred in with, like, Luffy right underneath of Ace protecting Luffy, that's the way he went out, and just, like, it had a lot of impact to it, and it really, like, it really got you. It got the emotion that was trying to come across through the page. And I definitely feel like that shapes the series in ways that we really didn't think of, like holding back from any deaths before that, and then having that act as the first death in the series really adds a lot to it.
Yeah, there was a lot of other action going on right then. Real quickly, I'd like to get your thoughts on Akainu as a character. He's the one who kind of delivered the death blow. What are your thoughts on him? Because he was introduced fairly recently prior to him killing Ace. How do you feel about his character overall and the fact that he's the one striking the death blow when he's pretty much this brand new character?
He's not significant enough to be a major villain, but the fact that he kills Ace means that he's almost certainly going to show up as a motivation for Luffy down the line as a villain that he needs to be able to kill.
Mm-hmm. I feel like he's shaped to be the perfect bad guy. Like, he's the asshole. He's the admiral that you don't have to feel bad about hating because he's done nothing redeeming at all through the entire series. So I kind of feel like that set him up to have that kind of pure hatred directed towards him where you just don't like him for any reason.
Shortly after Ace's death, we have the revelation of Blackbeard's entire crew, which lends credence to the idea that Blackbeard is the ultimate antagonist to Luffy's crew, the Straw Hat Pirates. Because you get to see all these other new characters like Basco Shot and San Juan Wolf and these, you know, gargantuan new crew. How do you feel about the different crew members that were introduced, now including Shiryu, by the way, from Impel Down?
It's a properly villainous crew, if you ask me. Definitely, Blackbeard sets himself up very strongly as an antagonist to Luffy. And the crew themselves, definitely. There has to be one for every one of the Straw Hats, including at least one more crew member that we won't meet yet. So the fact that they've got lots of variety is a good thing. It'll lead to ultimately very interesting end-of-series fights if he is the final boss.
Clint?
Yeah, I thought Blackbeard's crew was just fitting for him. It was a bunch of, like, no-gooders and people that just, like, look despicable. And, like, all of his crew generally follows that guideline. They're all just, like, very clearly not good characters in any way, kind of stab you in the back characters.
Yeah, that's something that I very much appreciated, because a lot of what One Piece brings to the table in terms of plot and rivalry and antagonism is, you know, from the standpoint of the world government, which that brings the entire idea of sense of morality into play, because to regular citizens of the world of One Piece, the world government is actually the good guys and pirates are the bad guys, while we are cast as the audience into thinking that, you know, rightfully the Straw Hat Pirates are the good guys because they do right, even if that doesn't follow the laws of the world. So it's nice, it's kind of refreshing in a way to just see a good old-fashioned evil group, because it is nothing but just escaped criminals, and they weren't wrongfully imprisoned criminals, they're murderers. So, yeah, I totally agree with you there. Nice to see that they are just genuinely bad people. Right after Blackbeard's reintroduction to the action, he throws a cloak over Whitebeard, and a little bit of action goes on under there that we don't get to see, and then all of a sudden, Blackbeard has Whitebeard's power. We argued about this a little bit way back when this chapter actually came out. I was of the mindset that it cheapens the idea a little bit, because we've already gone a little off track with the entire concept of haki, which kind of it goes away from the uniqueness of every devil fruit. And now we have this one character who's able to use two different devil fruit powers. I didn't really approve of that. What were your thoughts on it, Drew?
My thoughts about it was that it made sense in the context of Blackbeard worked really, really hard to acquire this one power, this one devil fruit. He killed a crewmate. He ran away. He fought with Ace. He went to the effort to become one of the seven, like, government-sponsored pirates and just did a lot for this fruit, specifically researched it, because it's got to be much more powerful than the others. The ability to absorb other powers, especially powers on the level of, like, earthquake fruit, certainly lends credence to the original fact that he was seeking it so strongly.
Mm-hmm. Clint?
Yeah, I'm not sure what to think. I don't specifically like him having the earthquake power in addition to the black hole power he had, because the earthquake power is kind of a physical power, and that kind of gives him, like, too much of an all-round protection from everything. Like, he's good at anything now, and I don't look for that in a character. I'm still not certain like how he was able to get it. I mean, of course, none of us are because it hasn't been pointed out in the plot yet. But I don't know whether it's through this will of D that's been mentioned or if it's because of the fruit he took, like Drew was saying. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. That pretty much set up the conclusion of the war arc. There were a few other moments after that. We had Trafalgar Law, one of the 11 supernovas, showing up and saving Luffy, you know, demanding to be able to see him because he's a doctor and he can heal him. We had Kobe take his great stand, questioning why people were still fighting because it was just senseless bloodshed, and then Shanks arrives out of nowhere and saves the day. Finally, that does set up then the conclusion of the war arc. Even though the entirety of the war arc was not within the first half of this year, let's just retrospect, I guess, on that for a moment. I personally thought it was one of the strongest arcs in the entirety of One Piece. To me, it still doesn't quite reach the level of the Water 7 / Enies Lobby arc, but it's definitely one of the most powerful, specifically when you look at the death of both Ace and of Whitebeard. What were your thoughts on it, Clint?
Yeah, it was definitely a great arc, and besides being just great, like you were saying, it has a lot of importance. Not my favorite arc, but certainly in terms of important things occurring, it is the biggest arc, because so many things happen that are just going to shape One Piece for the next couple years.
Drew?
It's not as emotional as Water 7, but it is as impactful to the plot. It may not have like quite the emotional take. It has an emotional take, but it delivers a huge impact to the plot, and certainly with the regathering of the crew, which we'll be seeing later, which we'll be getting to later, it leads to a lot of interesting possibilities.
Speaking of it leading to interesting possibilities, we shortly thereafter had the introduction of a character who really does bring about the most interesting of possibilities, perhaps often spoken of in reverential terms almost, in terms of being the most important character in the entire history of the series, and that's Brownbeard. How did you feel the moment that you first saw Brownbeard, Drew?
Love. That's what it was. Also, I think he's going to be Buggy the Clown's ultimate rival.
That would be pretty great. Clint, do you have any strong words about Brownbeard, this amazing character?
May he live forever.
Indeed. So then our next major arc this year in One Piece has been this flashback, looking back at Luffy and Ace, their brotherhood together as children, being raised by Dedan, and also the introduction of their third sworn brother, Sabo. This was an interesting arc. That kind of came out of nowhere. Apparently, there were some small artistic hints as to the existence of Sabo beforehand. You can look at the... Clint had mentioned once the Sakazuki, the sake cup, that was just barely off-screen in a panel during the war arc. And also, there's a strong hint of Ace's tattoo, the crossed-out S, being representative of Sabo. But we had no real way of knowing that this character is who those things represented. Thoughts on Sabo as a character, him being introduced here, and the possibilities storyline-wise that he opens up? Clint?
I think Sabo could play a bunch of different roles. Regardless of whether or not he makes it out of the flashback, which we don't know about. If he does, we're sure to see him. Even if he doesn't, his memory is obviously going to like spur Luffy in ways that we can only imagine.
What do you think, Drew?
Sabo is sort of Schrodinger's character. You don't know whether he's dead or not. He could be, but they don't have the body, so they don't really know. And he just could be introduced or he could not be. I know it's planned out, but it really could go either way.
Right. That is kind of the classic comic book rule, not just manga, but comics in general. If you don't see the corpse, assume that they are not dead. So I'm completely unwilling to decide that Sabo has passed away. In this flashback, we also see the revolutionaries show up at one point, which includes Dragon, Ivankov, and Kuma, very interestingly. And then we do have that moment thereafter, where Sabo is leads us to believe that he is killed. And then we slowly kind of do a flash forward. It's not just a quick take back to present time, but it's actually a slow transition of scenes of Luffy particularly growing up over time, returning to eventually present day, a scene of Luffy kneeling on the ground crying, bemoaning his own lack of power. Thoughts on that flashback as a whole and the transition back to where we are now. What do you think, Drew?
I think just the transition back from the flashback makes sense where it was. If it had been any later, it probably would have made less sense. And now we have Sabo if we need to reintroduce him or else just have Luffy have some sort of other memories of him. And also, the transition out of the flashback was extremely well done. Just the transition to all these future scenes, Ace setting off with hopes and him having hopes of his own, and then just we flash forward to present day, Ace is dead, and Luffy is an emotional wreck.
Right. What were your thoughts on that flashback in its entirety, Clint?
I thought the flashback was well-placed, if not exactly what I wanted after the high pace of the war arc. I mean, it was kind of like an immediate drop in action. You have that gut response to like, oh, it's a flashback. But like Drew said, if it was anywhere else, it wouldn't have fit. So I think this was the only time that we could have done it.
Right.
So I generally approve of it.
Okay, and for each of these series that we cover, we're going to give for you our favorite moment, or perhaps what we deem to be the most important moment, the most notable moment. So it's not always the best, it's just what struck out as most notable to us in any given series during this half-year period. So, Clint, what was the highlight for you?
The death of Ace. I mean, far and away, just Ace being gone and right in front of Luffy's eyes was the most impactful event that had happened.
Drew?
For me, it was just the transition out of the flashback scene in that last part. The part where Luffy's just, like, there on the ground saying, Pirate King? I'm going to be the Pirate King? Yeah, right. And then the admission that he's weak sends such a strong impact after all of the events of the war arc that we've seen.
And for me, echoing Clint, it was also the death of Ace. I mean, like I've said many times prior, it to me is just the most important moment that we're going to see for a long time coming, just because of the different storyline opportunities that it presents for Oda to be able to work on. But even not considering it from that standpoint, even just regarding it on its own as an impactful plot point, just by far and away, in my opinion, the strongest moment of this year. Let us move now to Naruto. The chapter span we're covering is chapters 477 to 499. And going back to 477, that puts us right in the middle of the Sasuke and Danzo fight. This was an interesting fight, at least in terms of new powers being revealed on both sides. What were your thoughts on this fight, Clint?
I really didn't like it. This was still in a portion of Naruto that was obviously Sasuke heavy. And I really don't like Sasuke, so any panel that he's in is basically a loss. But aside from that, like, it was a display of powers that are just, like, way too over the top. I liked Naruto more when everyone was kind of, like, most of the people were on an even footing at least. People had a chance in fights, but, like, this was kind of giving us a feel that, like, now there are those few characters that, like, no one can even come close to.
Right. Drew, what did you think?
I think it's sort of, like Clint said, it takes away from the suspense of the fights when Sasuke is Sasuke and he's obviously going to win against anybody who's not a main character.
Yeah. He does tend to ruin anything he touches, as it were. After that fight ended, with Danzo having been killed, Sakura shows up, and there's a short face-off between Sakura and Sasuke where she fortunately reveals that she had been planning all along to kill him. We were really worrying back when these chapters came out that Sakura had lost any credibility at all that she had had as a character, which admittedly was not very much given Sakura's past history, but at least she had had some. It seemed as though she was going to go off and run off with Sasuke and join his little hawk group. She is revealed to be out to kill him. There's a face-off between the two, and then Naruto shows up along with Kakashi, slightly separated time-wise. This entire Team 7 showdown, how do you feel that it was handled? Was it still suffering from the stigma of being more Sasuke plot, Drew?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you have a little light, like Naruto being the enemy of Sasuke, but still wanting to save him as a friend, and ultimately it detracts from Naruto as a character that he has to drag Sasuke around, because he himself is moderately interesting. Not the most interesting character in the series, but good enough to carry himself around.
I can see that. What did you think about this, Clint?
Too much angst. It was Sasuke all over. It was the angst and the crying and the everyone screaming at each other that I've just come to loathe.
Sometime after that entire showdown ended, we have a very important note on the villain side of things, which is the reappearing of Kabuto, who we had not seen for quite some time, and he looks a little bit different, and he is revealed to have these different jutsu at his command, and he makes an offer that Madara apparently for some reason can't refuse because of some piece of information that he divulges to Madara that he knows. Clint, at the time, you posed a very interesting theory. What was that?
It was that the coffin that he showed to Mata that basically got him accepted by him was Madara himself in the coffin. That the Madara we think is Madara is not actually him.
Right. That would really pose very, very interesting possibilities. Drew, did you have thoughts on that theory or thoughts on this showdown whatsoever?
I was not too paying attention to this. I just sort of watched it for what it was. Kabuto makes a threat. Madara acquiesces. It's something.
There was a period of time where Naruto was really bemoaning his own lack of strength, so he needed to improve, and in great shonen tradition, cue the training arc. There was actually a pre-training arc, which was kind of bizarre, but ultimately it leads us to one of the more interesting moments in recent history, interesting used loosely, which was the appearance of Dark Naruto, where Naruto is sitting under a waterfall and having this kind of fight within himself against his angsty version. Against all the feelings of hatred that have been bottled up inside.
Which he wins via a hug.
Yeah.
I was somewhat impressed by this arc. Because Naruto isn't really a dark character, the appearance of a dark side may seem out of place until you realize that he does have his own set of issues bottled up inside. So Dark Naruto kind of made sense to me, as did the eventual way that he defeated him by just embracing him and saying, you're a part of me too, so I guess stop being so hostile towards everyone.
Clint, what did you think?
I thought that the hug was all right, but personally I would have used Den's fire.
well done. Yeah, I frankly completely disagree, respectfully, of course, but I really found this to be fairly trashy. I've never been a fan of the self versus dark self entire plot device. I feel that it's very immature, really. It shows a lack of storytelling ability, which I feel that Kishimoto is just better than. It's certainly by far not one of the worst instances of this plot device being used. I just feel that it's such a weak plot device that it shouldn't be used. Later on, after he actually is able to clear that portion of his training, he wants Killer B to train him, but for some reason Killer B won't, and Motoi explains Killer B, this character, through flashback, and he reveals the history between himself and Killer B. We kind of complained at the time about the positioning of this flashback, although it was fairly short, just the positioning where it was when we had been trying to focus on Naruto. What are your thoughts on Killer B, Motoi, and the placement of this flashback, Clint?
It was an all right flashback, tolerable because of how short it was, and it did give us some insight into like Killer B's character, but I thought it was really pointless. Like, we were trying to focus on Naruto, and they're showing us a flashback of a Jinchuriki being like tormented and no one likes them, and like, yeah, we've seen this because we're watching Naruto, and it's about Naruto. And we've also seen Gaara, who was also the same story. So this is the last story we need to be told again.
Drew?
True. I think the flashback was mainly tolerable just because it was short, not for any other reason.
Right. Now we finally get to where I think, in all of our opinions, the series really began to turn around and become enjoyable again, which is when Naruto finally has to go inside of himself, loosen the seal, and take on the Kyuubi head-on. And this is not just a huge pinnacle of a moment in the series because it's been this fight, this battle within that's been raging for the entire length of the series. But even just the chapter itself, or themselves, the battle is gargantuan. It's really momentous. I think that, Clint, you were really impressed by this at the time, were you not?
Yeah, the fight that was going on was like, it took Naruto back to its storytelling days from the beginning, and I was really impressed with what was being done, and like the fight was action-paced and good, and there were new techniques coming out that you were like, you saw it and you were like surprised by it, like, oh, I wouldn't have imagined that.
Right. Drew, what did you think about this?
Well, there's a nice, interesting degree of like epic scale to it, which is appropriate since it's effectively the series' biggest villain. Even before anyone else, the fox was sort of like tormenting Naruto. So it definitely gives you an appropriate sense of scale, and it was a nice fight.
And then during this fight, in which they are trying to each pull the chakra out of one another, which was never exactly explained, but, you know, we'll take it for face value, whatever. Naruto is weak, and he's not performing as well as he needs to be, even with some help from Killer Bee and the Octopus. And finally, a not terribly familiar voice speaks out to him and reaches out to him, and it's Kushina, it's his mother. And he has a little bit of a pseudo-flashback conversation inside of himself, so different layers going on here. Thoughts on the reappearance, or I guess first appearance in a way, of his mother at this stage in the story, and the conversation that they have. Drew?
The conversation that they have, especially the flashback to, like, older days, is interesting because you learn the reason why he's wearing Road Cone Orange, or at least, quote, the reason.
Right.
And it's not the best reason, but at least it's interesting and is a nice break through the fight. Her herself lending help to Naruto is, I'm sort of so-so on that. Like, maybe she had to do it in order to win, but it feels like a rather cheaper plot device than him just beating the Kyuubi by himself.
Clint?
I thought it was a good time to reintroduce Naruto's mom. Like, we had seen his dad, he had talked to his dad, and his parents were this kind of, like, everyone was waiting to know when they would come up and we would learn more about him. So, like, this is probably the good time following after he saw his dad in the pain fight, now seeing his mom while he's trying to capture the fox from within himself and control its power.
Right, I pretty much feel exactly the same way. If this had to happen, it pretty much had to happen now, because there's not really any particularly other good point at which to do it. And certainly, even if this if it didn't feel like the optimal time to do it, I certainly would not want to have to revisit this later. So, decently enjoyable in terms of the conversation itself, and certainly acceptable in terms of positioning. That takes us to the midway point of the year where we're cutting off. So, Clint, what was your highlight so far this year in Naruto?
When Naruto finally conquered the fox and just gained control over its chakra.
Drew?
For me, it was the gag immediately prior to going to train, like, to control the fox, the moment where he becomes head, where he, like, walks into a temple with all these headless statues, sticks his head inside a mouth, and then pretends to be headless for a little while. It's a really nice joke set up because Killer Bee's in on it too, and they're just in it to fool Yamato.
That was a fantastic moment. And my highlight of the year is the reintroduction of Kabuto, which I feel is potentially very important because I feel that the villains in this series have been extremely underwhelming, especially Madara, who we just, you know, this entire Moon's Eye plan is fairly laughable, bouncing his Sharingan off the moon to enslave the entirety of the Earth. I feel that Kabuto, if he is developed correctly, could be the kind of tactical, incisive villain that this series really needs. So, to me, that was the standout moment of the year. Bleach, chapters 387 through 409. where we began this year in Bleach, believe it or not, was a bunch of captains fighting Aizen, which feels as though it took a long time. There was a lot of that content to go around, wasn't there, Drew?
Oh, Lordy, yes. The whole of this stretch of Bleach can be described by Aizen, Aizen, and more Aizen.
Yeah. Clint, put into words, if you possibly can, how much you loved the incessant fights between various captains and Aizen.
Well, it was pretty much everyone in the series and their brother shows up and fights Aizen. And no one wins. So it was pretty stupid.
Finally, after we realize that no one can win, Yamamoto Genryusei steps up, the grand leader of Soul Society, to actually step up and fight himself for once, to show the young kids how it's done. Take charge himself, and he doesn't succeed because he's up against Aizen and the characters that Aizen has created or deemed necessary to be around him, to be able to handle fights for him. So what did you think about the Yamamoto fight, if you even want to call it that, really, Clint?
Yeah, having a character tailor-made to counter who we've been told is, like, one of the strongest people in the series strikes me as a little just retarded. But it also fits up with, like, everything that happens Aizen has planned for. Everything is perfectly according to what he wants.
Yeah. Drew?
It was absolutely a disappointment, which kind of describes Bleach as a whole.
You're noticing a theme here, listeners. Eventually, in grand Bleach tradition, characters show up out of nowhere, the first of which was Isshin, Ichigo's father, and that kind of splits up the action into two main fights. One of them was between Isshin and Aizen, and the other one was between Ichigo and Gin, who is revealed to have a very let's say, spectacular power.
Altogether now.
13 kilometers.
Yeah.
That, my goodness. Okay, so legitimately, we don't have high expectations anytime each of us read a Bleach chapter. That said, there are still moments that throw us for a loop. Not in a good way, mind you, of course. But your initial reaction, Drew, when you first read that his power was to extend his Zanpakuto 13 kilometers.
Lol, what? There's not much to say. It's just a crazy power. And I would like to say that the fight shown using that power was actually kind of reasonable and mimicked the better moments of Bleach where people use their swords tactically. But that said, what a ridiculous power.
Clint, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, when it was first revealed, it was really just like the crowning disappointment so far of everything in Bleach, that like it hinges on revealing these completely like awesome powers that all the Zanpakuto have, like through Bankai, and his was to grow even longer, and it was just a little ridiculous. I mean, it was slightly offset by the fact that its true power is to like grow or shrink really fast, I guess, but still ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, when it was thereafter kind of amended to reveal that the actual strength of the Zanpakuto over the Bankai specifically was that it's the fastest in terms of how quickly it can retract and extend, that redeemed it partially. But I think it was more at that point we would take anything that would alter the ridiculousness of 13 kilometers. The major plot point afterwards was Aizen finally fusing with the Hogyoku and basically turning into unbreakable, broken, plot-destroying monster. And certain other characters have shown up at this point to try to combat this. Urahara, Kisuke shows up. Yoruichi shows up with a bunch of weird armor plate stuff on her limbs. But they are not exactly effective against him. This entire stretch of plot, what'd you think, Drew?
Trash. Absolute trash. Just a twist. Twist once a chapter that leads to Aizen eventually coming out of his cocoon and becoming a beautiful butterfly.
Yeah, no kidding. I particularly loved the character design of this partially fused, you know, imperfect cell, if you were, this partially fused Hogyoku / Aizen, where it almost looks as though Kubo has just given himself more white on which to not draw. Clint, what'd you think of all this?
It was one of the stupidest transformations I've ever seen. That being said, giving Aizen more powers than what he already had, the Kyoka Suigetsu, the one that made everyone hallucinate things, basically, seems stupid. He was already a strong enough villain. Let's go ahead and have the hero power up and then get to fighting him. But no, we give him just an unreasonably large power up.
Right. All the while this is going on, even though we never really cut to the action for any extended period of time, Gin and Ichigo have been fighting, supposedly. And this is kind of one of the better moments of the year, at least in my opinion, where basically Gin is kind of he kind of becomes the ombudsman of the series, where he takes the feedback of the audience and then inputs it directly into the story canon, where he's basically just calling out Ichigo for being useless, you know, making fun of him for not being powerful enough, and then not having the conviction to hollowify, and then wanting to run away. And these are all things that we, each of us, had been saying about Ichigo as a character all that time. While their fight may not have been terribly interesting or action-packed whatsoever, what did you think of this exchange, or this series of exchanges, Clint?
It was pretty awesome, just watching Gin call Ichigo out, like telling him he's creepy, and because Ichigo would say things like, "I'll defeat you for my friends," or weird things that he was saying, and just Gin saying, "You're this useless, you're going to run away, I guess I have to kill you now."
Right. Drew?
I didn't think too much of it, honestly. It's an interesting little meta commentary. I don't feel like Bleach is being that deep, and it was just coincidental. But
right. It just, to me, it made Gin a slightly more enjoyable character than any other character, simply because he was echoing what I thought. Do I give Kubo any credit for writing a character that was deliberately breaking the fourth wall? Not at all. I don't think that was the intent. So after all of this, the grand climax of the arc occurs, and Aizen basically just wipes the floor with everyone as expected and leaves. And so everyone realizes that they're not powerful enough. Ichigo is just completely at a loss for what to do, so it's training time, and his father takes him into this bizarro netherworld that's between worlds. Basically, it's another version of the hyperbolic time chamber. Time moves at a different pace. He'll have all the time he needs to train. And he's going to try to learn the final form of his new move. So he goes once again and meets with Zangetsu, who is now a different, more youthful, more bishi Zangetsu. Drew, thoughts on this entire passage of time, and very specifically the new Zangetsu?
Why? You already had a character design for him. He hasn't undergone any visible change in the meanwhile. It just seems like something that's kind of unnecessary that's going to be explained through Bowl. Like, again, like everything I say, typical Bleach, because it really is what Bleach does. It replaces fun characters with bad ones and just does a lot of Bowl. All
right. Clint, thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a little stupid. I also think Ichigo going into a training arc for the one move he has is almost insulting to the fans. Like, give him more moves, make him more interesting of a character. Don't just elaborate on the only attack he has.
Right. And then finally, the last thing before the midway point of the year is Aizen walking through the town and coming upon all of Ichigo's friends, who he claims he's going to kill or incapacitate or hurt in some capacity to spur Ichigo into further transformation for his, Aizen's, own sake. Thoughts on that finale point where we are right now?
At least it lent some credibility to Aizen as a villain for a little bit.
I suppose so.
At least he's committing, if not genocide, then murder. He kills a random salaryman, too.
True.
But really just not an entertaining villain still. Just sort of doing everything passively without doing it comically passively, like waving a hand and all of a sudden the country's gone.
And for me, it was just the sheer lunacy, the sheer insult of a moment that was the revelation that everything has been according to Aizen's plan all along. And that just, to me, quite frankly, and I've looked over my chapter ratings for everything, this is the worst moment in manga so far this year. And that's just since I've begun taking chapter ratings. It was so horribly insulting and terrible that it's probably one of the single worst manga moments of any manga that I've ever read. Overwhelmingly horrible. Let us move now outside of the quote-unquote big three. We're going to take a look at Bakuman. We began this year at chapter 68 and moved through chapter 91. These are really plot-heavy chapters, so bear with me. We're going to kind of move a little bit more quickly. When we caught up to our cast at the beginning of this year, they were working still on Run Daihatsu Tanto. All the while, Takagi and Kaya were planning to get married, which was a little bit of a awkward comedy of errors all the while. You had a little smaller moments in the background, like Fukuda was helping Aoki better write more interesting female characters because she was writing female characters with her perspective on shoujo manga, not shonen manga. You had Nakai leaving the main cast. And then finally, the first real standout moment of the year to me was Iwase coming back into the main cast here. And she has begun to write manga, which what ended up becoming Plus Natural, or just Natural, however you should pronounce it. What did you think of plot till that point, Clint, but especially the moment when Iwase is brought back into the fold?
Well, I think I was getting a little bit tired of Tanto at that point, and it was exactly the twist on the plot that I wanted to see happen, like Iwase coming back into it, and she's this, like, she's another rival, and she's a new writer, and she's working with AG, so it was really cool to see.
Definitely. There was some drama going on in the background all the while. There was that bizarre hint of a love triangle. No, I suppose it was more of a love square, polyangle there between Takagi and Iwase and Aoki all the while Takagi was trying to get married to Kaya. So a lot of female romantic issues going on with Shujin there. You had smaller, funnier moments like Otters 11 finally getting an anime, which I suppose in and of itself wasn't funny, but Otters 11 is hilarious. Iwase, now freshly back into the main cast and completely confused by every turn of events, as she had had that crush on Takagi, and that was obviously spurned in favor of Kaya, she turns her attention to Hattori. And I remember we've made a lot of comments about these different exchanges when Hattori was meeting with Iwase to discuss business, and it turned into much more. What did you think of that part of the plot, Clint?
It was pretty funny, actually, like seeing Iwase trying to, like, woo Hattori and him just, like, at a loss for what to do. He's just trying to do his job as an editor.
You mentioned being tired of Tanto. I think that was kind of what we were supposed to be feeling by this point in the story. And you really have this ramp up towards a climax here when Eiji is on television being interviewed, and he's asked about who he considers his rival, and he very brashly points to the camera and says, "My rival is Ashirogi Muto-sensei," which catches everyone by surprise because to the rest of the audience, Ashirogi is basically, you know, successful but fairly low level, certainly nowhere near the same tier as Eiji, and that's the wake-up call to Ashirogi, who are writing Tanto, very specifically to Mashiro, who's had these awkward feelings not wanting to do this series all the while, and you have a really powerful moment, in my opinion, where he breaks down crying, runs to the phone, and actually calls Azuki, something which was previously unthinkable. This entire turn of events, how did you feel about this?
It was exactly what needed to happen. Like you said, we were supposed to be tired of Tanto because they wanted us to feel along with what the characters felt, and they were both so tired of Tanto. Like, you could tell Takagi was getting, like, he was getting short on jokes to write, and Ashiro just wasn't having fun drawing, and he really wanted to compete with Eiji, especially after Eiji made that comment on TV. And the phone call with Azuki was really just, like, the crowning moment of importance through all this. Like, you know, it's something's about to go down seriously when he calls her.
Right. Thereafter, a slightly more positive moment, I suppose. There's the wedding between Takagi and Kaya. I say I suppose because there were still moments of drama therein. You had Mashiro basically confronting Hattori, who was not his editor at the time, mind you. It was still Miura, confronting a different author's editor on whether they're doing the right series, whether they should be working on a different series. Granted, that was the backdrop towards a very positive moment, which was Takagi and Kaya getting married. Finally, you have Mashiro growing this backbone. This is the beginning of the point where Mashiro starts to seriously evolve as a character. He had previously been a good character, a deep enough character, but he had never really been completely committed simply because he was stuck working on series that he didn't love as much as what he could be doing. This was the beginning of the point where he really starts to take charge, grow a spine, and he goes into the Shueisha office, faces off with the editor-in-chief, and says he wants to quit Tanto. The editor-in-chief naturally says, well, fine, you know, you can quit Tanto, but don't ever expect to work for Jump again. And so Takagi obviously is taken aback by that, says, oh, yes, obviously, that's the right course of action. We'll reconsider. And Mashiro stands his ground for once and says, well, what do you think, Takagi? Do we still want to work for Jump? To me, an extremely powerful moment. What did you think of this entire plot?
Yeah, that was definitely, like, the biggest moment of the series for me so far. Like, Mashiro just having that outstanding drive, like, knowing that they weren't going to go anywhere with Tanto and just wanting it, like, off of them so they can start working on something new, and him having the conviction to actually, like, force that to happen was something the plot needed, and it was enjoyable to read.
So that entire turn of events led to a bunch of shorter mini story arcs. It was a little bit more episodic chapter by chapter after that point. There were some plot lines that were extended over the chapters. Hattori and Miura actually teamed up, you know, which is an unprecedented thing, to have two different editors teaming up behind the back of the editors. So they team up for the benefit of Ashirogi, who now, through that, are getting all these fresh new ideas and are put to developing a bunch of different new series, many of which fail or are met with less than completely positive reception, but Mashiro quickly catches on to exactly what it is that Miura is doing, Miura through the team of both him and Hattori. They come up with this concept of serious humor, which they are intending to use to develop the name for their next series. You have a bunch of different comedic moments in here as well. I particularly love any mention of Weekly Aoki Co. I think that you did as well, didn't you?
Yeah, that was just a great segment, talking with the author of Otters 11 and his editor, and they're just like, the only way he can get that author to work is by offering him, like, these little tidbits on another author.
Right. Yeah, absolutely fantastic humor there. But then obviously they're still working out ideas. One of the best chapters of the year, in my opinion at least, was the chapter in which they, being Ashirogi, tail Hattori in his daily affairs. Just, you know, they don't think anything suspiciously of him. They don't think that he's up to any wrongdoing. They're just tailing him for some reason because Takagi has a plan. And finally it's revealed that he has this idea for a series regarding the perfect crime. crime not in the sense of committing what we think of as, you know, serious, horrible crimes, but just something that is executed to complete perfection to baffle and astound whoever it is that finds out about it. And this is demonstrated in an excellent moment where they switch out Azuki's birthday present. What did you think of the perfect crime concept and the actual execution of it when they try it out on Azuki to see how well it's received?
This little mini arc was like the greatest arc I've come across so far in Bakuman. I mean, them trailing Hattori was hilarious. I cannot wait to see that animated in the upcoming anime. And then like the idea itself was great. Them switching out Azuki's present was just like, it gave you a feeling as to what they were going to be doing when they were writing their next series.
Ultimately, they come up with this idea for a series called The Perfect Crime Club. That is a tentative title, and it is voted upon. And it is met with some resistance based on the outlandish stance that they took, where, you know, they have to come up with this new series that is good enough to rival Eiji, or else they'll be permanently kicked out of Jump and obviously Shueisha as a whole. And it is, fortunately, voted on as a yes, which, you know, we have obviously discussed if it had to be voted in simply because what other magazine are they going to go to? But ultimately, it is voted into the magazine, and you have some great reaction shots in that chapter, by the way, of the crew getting that phone call, the celebratory cake-eating parade. What'd you think of that, very briefly?
It was awesome. Like when they, especially after that phone call that they received, when they then called Eiji and told him that they were getting serialized, and Mashiro was being all like intensely serious, and rivalry was going on, and he had cake all over his face, and Kyle was still like cramming down cake in the background.
Loved it. So this began a transitional period in a way where they're actually starting to set up for this new series that they're writing. One of the main things is that Hattori and Miura switch roles. Miura now the editor of Natural with Iwase and Eiji, and Hattori is back to working with Ashirogi, who he originally was working with. In all of this, this furthers the development of Mashiro specifically as a character, where he comes up with the idea of only being given the manuscripts instead of being given a name with panel design and everything, because that frees his interpretation of Takagi's scripts. New assistants come in, and this again reflects positively on Mashiro's evolution as a character because of his entire speech about what he feels manga writing is all about. And they finally decide upon the title Perfect Crime Party, which unfortunately, or fortunately, however you wish to look at it, shortens to PCP. I'd like to get your thoughts, Clint, if you would, on Mashiro's evolution right here as a character. The way that he's not just standing up for himself as he did against the editor-in-chief, but he's also expressing himself a little bit more. What did you think of this?
It was pretty good. He's definitely growing as a mangaka, as an artist, and he's also like forcing Takagi to grow as a writer. Like Takagi's elaborating more on the plots and stuff he's writing because he's working on the manuscripts alone, not doing a name or anything like that.
After this, we are made to remember that it's not just a direct competition between Ashirogi and Eiji. There are some other mangaka out there, and one of them is Fukuda, who premieres a new series entitled Road Racer because he feels as though he's being left in the dust by all these different turns of events. He wants to get back in the picture, comes up with Road Racer, and it goes head-to-head with PCP in serialization. First week results of the survey for serialization, PCP voted number one, and the results of that survey, Mashiro grabs them, and we don't exactly know what he's going to do with them. We're made to think that he's going to call Azuki and brag a little bit about them, but instead it takes a very serious and amazing turn when he goes to the graveyard of his uncle, the late mangaka himself, and presents the survey results, and he says, you know, we'll come back when we succeed even further. That takes us to the midway point of this year, and it ends on a very touching note. How did you feel about that scene, Clint?
It was perfectly placed and well done. It had you feeling the emotion. It came out of nowhere and left equally quickly, like the pure raw like emotion that you would feel through the scene.
Mm-hmm. So then what would you consider your highlight of the year so far in Bakuman?
Mashiro facing off against the editor and just telling him that they wanted to quit Tonto.
For me, it was the scene where Mashiro, crying, breaks down and calls Azuki. Found it extremely powerful to be able to overcome his stubbornness and shyness, to just break down and call her. A lot of character growth in Mashiro as a whole over this half year. Really pleased with that. Beelzebub, for this half year, chapters 43 through 66. At the beginning of the year, we are still in the demon world, actually, right when we are finding out that the main heroes need to save Alain Delon's daughter, who originally we only know the name, Angelica. Some rather comedic moments at the very beginning here, where Futoichi is terrified of being in this demon world. He doesn't really want any part of this quest, and then he finds a picture. Drew, you want to elaborate on that?
The picture he finds in particular in this case is the picture of Alain Delon's daughter, and previously they had imagined that maybe it was either like a fat, muscle-bound daughter or a squid, as Baby Beale would have you believe.
Yeah.
But she's actually kind of hot, and so Furuichi, of course, goes into like fake Bishi mode.
Right.
To everyone's enjoyment.
Of course. They are met with absolute terror outside of this the house in which they finally find, or the prison, pardon me, in which they finally find Angelica. The demon beast is running about, and that leads to a really interesting, hilarious, fantastic reaction from one of our favorite characters of this series. What exactly happens here, Clinton? What did you think of it?
The huge demon beast shows up, and Bael just also, he sees the demon beast, and he feels the challenge, and he just grows huge. And we see a giant monster battle between this demonic beast and a little baby who has grown to, you know, monstrous proportions. And it's such a great fight.
It's our very own little kaiju battle in Beelzebub. What do you think of this, Drew?
I enjoyed it. I thought the whole scene where Baby Beel is just busting out wrestling moves on a giant beetle-type monster was just worth a thousand words, that picture.
To me, there are a few scenes in this series that I want to see animated more. Obviously, I want to see it because the entirety of it is just fantastic, but I get the feeling it's just going to be one of those priceless moments of awkward, interrupting comedy where Baby BL just grows to this gargantuan size, and everyone is just absolutely flabbergasted as to what's going on, and there's just this pause. And I want to hear Oga himself just say, "Charge, attack!" Just that moment right there, fantastic comedy as it was in the manga. I couldn't wait to see that in the anime adaptation, which hopefully will be forthcoming. Ultimately, that fight takes place, and at the end of that, they're saved by some mysterious character who we don't really know anything about, but ultimately the Demon World arc ends, and we are brought to a brand new school because their old school was trashed by Oga, of course. We are introduced to the six horsemen who kind of run the place here, and we meet one very specific member of the Six Horsemen, Miki, who turns out to be a rather important character. Thoughts on End of the Demon World, but more specifically, introduction and transition into this new school arc, Drew?
The actual introduction transition into the school arc I thought was handled fairly well. You got these delinquents being given to the toughest teacher in the school and then turning him into a sniveling wreck who cuts class every day.
All right.
Within, like, the first day was a very good comedy moment. The actual foreshadowing was all right, not great.
Clint?
I thought that the Demon World arc ended too soon for my tastes. I would have loved to have seen it go on longer and be elaborated more upon. But I was so pleased with Beelzebub at this point that I was just happy to get anything, and it looked like it was going to be pretty good so far.
We have several smaller fights take place, you know, important in the grand scheme of things, not as important. We have Kunieda versus one of the members of the Six Horsemen, who I believe still remains unnamed. He's a bamboo swords user. Kanzaki kind of flips out and just starts attacking a whole bunch of random people before he is ultimately taken out by Miki in what we believe to be one shot. I don't think we get to see it. This eventually leads to a four-on-four showdown on the roof between members of the Six Horsemen and Oga and his little group, which then leads to a massive punch from Oga on one of the members, who's apparently self-renowned for being a bit of a speed freak, just flying around all over the place and just met with a powerful fist from Oga, just sends him flying. And then after that, we come to the first flashback of thus far two, we hope only two, of Miki, because the Oga-Miki fight leads right into this flashback. What did you think of the series of fights on the roof and the beginnings of this flashback for Miki? Clint, I'd like to get your thoughts first.
First of all, the punch that Oga delivered onto the unsuspecting member of the Six Horsemen was great. It was just so awesome when that guy was talking up his game and then Oga just put a fist in his face and sent him across the roof. But what happened after that was less than pleasing, where Miki kind of just hits Oga and he doubles over and can't move for a while.
Drew?
I mean, I thought overall that this series of fights on the roof was well choreographed. You had 4-on-4, but you certainly had people pairing up into fighting partnerships that you wouldn't initially expect to happen. And you had a little bit of entertaining action, then the one-hit kill punch, and in the end of it, you do get some good comedy out of it, but a little bit of bad because Miki has that one-hit kill punch of his.
Exactly, that is a bit disappointing. So Oga is temporarily out of the picture, and you see kind of a reshuffling of who is fighting whom in this series of fights on the roof, and Kanzaki comes back. He's back on his feet and wanting revenge against Miki, who is the one to take him out in the first place, and he steps up, and he's about to get in the fight, and there's Oga, who sends him flying with a bit of friendly fire. I found this hilarious. Agreement, Drew?
It was definitely a good bit of comedy, especially the way the chapter itself sets it up is especially good without spoiling anything major.
Clint?
Yeah, it was funny.
The rest of the six horsemen show up, and things kind of die down. Tojo shows up, and there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of fights that are hinted at being about to happen, but ultimately everything rather disappointingly dies down at this point. We were ready for more fights, even if some of the fights would have been disappointing because, like Drew said about Miki's one-hit kill punch that we don't look upon too favorably, we still wanted more action and for this all to be resolved in one go, and it was not. It is ultimately... The plot segues into this scene where all the characters involved on the quote-unquote good side of things, meaning Oga and his entire faction, are about to be expelled. They're up for expulsion, but they strike a deal where there's going to be a sports festival where the two teams, the Six Horsemen versus Oga's faction, are going to fight against each other. You have a lot of other moments where Hildegard transfers into the school, for example, and this entire thing kind of turns into a big focus on volleyball. There's going to be a big volleyball showdown. There's one tiny moment of note where Hildegard has a conversation with Elendilon about a demon lurking within the school. That is yet to be expanded upon. It's potentially interesting. Ultimately, though, a lot of focus on volleyball training, which is kind of silly. Again, not the fights that we've been wanting. But we do finally get back to some action right before the halfway point of the year with another showdown between Oga and Miki, and then another flashback for Miki. So very specifically regarding this second showdown between Oga and Miki and his flashback, Clint, what did you think of this?
It was a... pretty interesting.
Drew?
I thought it was an interesting flashback, an interesting fight more because of Baby Beelzebub's moments in it, which is kind of true of any fight in Beelzebub. But the actual fight itself was a bit of a disappointment insofar as Miki just, like, does his whole thing where he's being depressed about Oga and then, like, delivers his punch again.
Right. So highlight of the year then, Clint?
My highlight of the year for Beelzebub was... Baby BL growing huge and just facing off against the large demon.
Drew?
My highlight of the year was the full page spread of Beelzebub giving the demon beast the Boston Crab hold.
That was fantastic. And mine is the one-hit knockout punch on that speed demon member of the Six Horsemen. Going to move now to Fairy Tale, which encompasses chapters 165 through 190. At the very beginning of the year, we had Gildarts returning to Fairy Tale, the guild, and he, you know, there's a little bit of banter in which he tells Natsu that he met up with a dragon. Natsu obviously has been on the lookout for his, you know, quote-unquote father, another dragon. The first standout moment of the year was Fairy Tale, the guild, disappearing out of nowhere, and you have this scene where just Natsu and Wendy and Charla are left there, and Happy is also there, lest I forget any cats, pardon me. So Fairy Tale, the guild, has disappeared. At this point, I will say I was actually interested. The second that happened, it was a week in which two chapters were released in the same week. At that very moment when I saw the guild disappear, I was rather interested by that. What were your thoughts on it? Put yourself back in that mindset for then, Drew.
It definitely was a very surprising way to start a story arc when we first saw it. All right, what's going to happen? You think it's going to be some magical group that just has somehow either annihilated them or taken them captive?
Ultimately, things did not go exactly as we would have written them. The story goes that Fairy Tale, the guild, has been drawn into a parallel world, which apparently exists, oh, by the way, in which there are characters that are the exact inverse of all the characters in Earthland, the real world, quote-unquote. So all these bizarro versions of these characters, like Natsu, who the Natsu we know is prone to motion sickness. He actually can only be at his best when he's in a vehicle. So, you know, hilarious. It's opposite day over there. And there are cats, and everyone is turned into crystals. Everyone who's a good guy has been turned into Lacrima crystals. And there are more cats. And because no one can use their magic yet, Lucy actually is displayed to be useful in her summons because they're not technically magic, so she can do them. And then there are more cats. And then Erza fights a clone of herself or a bizarro version of herself. And then Thriller Bark is ripped off, and there's a bunch of fights. I mean, jump in here at any point that you want, Drew. What is going on, and what are your thoughts?
A lot of unfortunate plot twists have been happening in Fairy Tail. One of the things you got to say about it is that it just didn't know where it was going into this arc, because initially, like, the idea of Bizarro doubles, it wasn't great, but again, the twist on Natsu having to be in a vehicle to use his best powers was interesting, but then the Village of Cats was a bit tried. Lucy being useful was somewhat interesting, but the moment when they get into the amusement park and they're fighting people who have the power to control toys, in the middle of an arc that's supposed to be somewhat serious, and a series that had taken itself seriously enough in action prior till now, it just does not fit.
No, absolutely not. And then you have a bunch of these fights between the main characters in Fairy Tail, Lucy, Gray, versus pretty much nobodies. I mean, I'm not asking for epically long story arcs revealing these certain villains to be strong and to establish their strength, but it's just, oh, here's some guy, you have to fight him now. To me, we pointed this out at the time in our Beamcast review of it, of that chapter. It also, aside from the face value ripoff of Thriller Bark, where they're actually, you know, fighting zombies and bizarre animals, it felt very much like a ripoff of the NES Lobby series of fights where they're running around a big tower where all the different crew members in One Piece or guild members in Fairy Tail are running around, each having a hand in their own fights, and then their fights become intertwined. So things are all over the place here. It ultimately leads up to the most very obvious plot moment of this year, where Erza is quite obviously pretending to be the Bizarro Erza. And it leads to a big showdown in front of the magic cannon and in front of the king. Gajil, all this while, by the way, is fighting Panther Lily. He's trying to fight him into submission, not defeat him, but actually
to make him a pet in true Gajil fashion, which is interesting.
Which actually, going back, as we did the research for this episode, if you look back at the very beginning of the year, it's either 165 or 166, there had been an established point in the character of Gajil who everyone around him had all these different cats, and he felt like he was a bit of an outcast, a bit different, because he didn't have a cat. So, yes, we're sick and damn tired of cats in this arc, but at least that was being true to the character, the fact that he wanted a cat of his own, and apparently Panther Lily looks like he's going to be the one.
At least it's not like one of the lame cats like everybody else looks like. It's a masculine cat.
Yeah, I think that's
like a muscle-bound humanoid body.
If he has to get a cat, that is the one for him, because that fits his character. He is slightly more brash and loner, if you will. We have the revelation that the leader of the cat, the queen of the cats, is actually useless, which I think you said you liked.
I was somewhat interested, not so much by the revelation that she was useless tying into, but by the whole chapter. It sort of was classic Mashima arc wrap-up, where all the citizens start to realize what's been happening and start lending a hand to the heroes. It was not as well done as any arc wrap-up in Rave Master, but I enjoyed it a little bit.
Mistogun shows up. He doesn't even really save the day. He just kind of shows up. I mean, he technically does stop the cannon from destroying them or what have you. Teleports away the magic Lacrima. But he doesn't really do anything of particular note. And we get to see that he is just Gerard again, and we find out his entire backstory, where he's technically the prince of this world. And then the king of this world, his father, gets into this weirdo dragon mech thing, which, again, you pointed
name.
Out. Yeah. Doromo, what is it?
Dorama Animu.
Thank you.
Like, you know how weeaboos pronounce it.
Yes, thank you very much. and, of course, you pointed out the other week, since someone has gotten involved with some kind of mechanical device, it's end of the arc time. This guy's about to be destroyed.
Oh, yeah. It just could not come quickly enough, because this has been just such a bad time for Fairy Tail, the whole other world arc.
Totally agree. But find, if you possibly can, whether positive or negative, the highlight, the standout moment of the year so far.
I think the one fight that I was really getting into was the fight Gray versus Sugar Boy, where they happen upon the key to the cannon and they're fighting over it. In the end, Gray smashes the key but is able to get a replacement to it to carry out his plan because he's an ahead thinker, and that was an interesting enough fight to hold my attention.
For me, it was the disappearance of the Fairy Tail Guild. Yes, unfortunately, I was let down by all subsequent plot twists, plot developments, but that moment right there is definitely the best I felt about Fairy Tail this entire year to date. Going to take a look now briefly at Katakyoshi Hitman Reborn, chapters 272 to 295. Frankly, if there are any fans of Reborn listening, I'm terribly sorry. I apologize, but we're not going to talk about the future arc because it was patently horrible. The most important thing to happen this year so far is the end of that arc. And frankly, I don't think that statement comes as any real surprise to most of you. There's been notable criticism of that arc and the way that it completely mutated and transformed and skewed everything that made Reborn so good at the beginning, just turned it into absolutely awful, awful storytelling. After the future arc, we get back a little bit to the original sense of episodic gag comedy. There's the introduction of this Shimon family, which, the moment they're introduced, we start to twinge a little bit and wonder, well, here's another family conveniently with the same number of people in its family as the Vongola family that we currently have established. I wonder if they're going to fight, he said in a foreshadowing method. We learn shortly after that about this Vongola sin, this small vial of what looks like some kind of a liquid, which is ultimately revealed to be blood, Shimon's blood, of the original Shimon leader, or the entire original Shimon family, pardon me. Upon finding out something that he was not to have known, Yamamoto is stabbed by a member of this Shimon family, who then are revealed to be the bad guys who have been targeting people and attacking different people. And are trying to ruin this inheritance ceremony for Tsuna to inherit the title of the 10th Vongola boss. To me, again, highlight of the year was just simply the fact that the future arc ended. Very recent turns of events have made me really skeptical about the way we're going again, because it's looking as though people are these different characters are becoming, again, too suave, too cool, which really is not at all the strength of this series. The series was at its best when Tsuna was this plucky, scaredy cat, Tsuna, somehow finding a way to overcome his own cowardice and do just enough to get by, show just enough heroism to get by. It was at its worst when he was just, let me save everything, I'll take care of it, generic shonen hero. And I fear that might be where we're headed again. I hope not. Let us now take a look at Hayate no Gotoku, Hayate the Combat Butler, chapters 254 to 277. Why don't you take us through a little bit of what's been happening in the plot here today, Clint?
So basically where it starts off is Nagi just broke the stone that everyone was fighting over, and she tells Hayate that he can go and save Athena now. So he goes off to do that.
Yeah, that entire Athena arc, I mean, it was not at the beginning of the year of the Athena arc, but, Hayate, to anyone who might not be familiar with Hayate as a series, you probably, from what you've heard, just assume that it is a comedy series, and for the most part, you might be right. It is a largely enjoyable comedy series, but a comedy series nonetheless. However, this time around, at this portion in the story, they're trying a very serious arc in which this long-lost childhood love of Hayate's is being possessed by this demon. So you're not just getting serious, but you're getting a little bit more of an element of supernatural than we had seen previously. Frankly, I absolutely was astonished and loved the Athena arc. What were your thoughts on it, Clint?
Yeah, the Athena arc was probably one of the best arcs we've had. I mean, there aren't really arcs in a comedy series like this, but the storyline behind Athena was just greatly well done. Not something you would expect from a comedy series.
You see the hotel in which many of the characters are staying is overcome by monsters, again lending itself to the entire supernatural aspect. You have Isumi, anytime supernatural involved, that she's not too far. She is ultimately captured by the Elder Spirit, who's controlling this entire faction of monsters. So Hayate has to come and save the day, and he is joined in his heroism by by a familiar character, if not exactly. Clint, who exactly is saving the day with Hayate here?
Well, it appears to be a Power Ranger, but it is actually Hinagiku, wielding like some kind of sacred sword.
Did you like this?
Yeah, it was well done. It was pretty funny.
Again, this show's ability to switch styles on the fly from Hata Kenjiro, the author. Yes, we've transitioned into a serious arc here, but by no means is it pure drama, pure angst, or anything like that. I mean, the moments of comedy are still fantastic. Ultimately, the Elder Spirit is defeated, and Athena is saved. And that brings us kind of back out of this really serious arc. There are still some ramifications from everything that has gone on, the most notable of which is Nagi, the young female protagonist, moves out, is somewhat forced to move out of her massive mansion and give up her massive inheritance. What did you think about the author sticking to his guns here and not just finding a way to retcon that entire idea in a comedic way, but actually saying, yes, this character, at least for now, is going to follow through on her promise to lose the inheritance?
Well, yeah, I mean, the normal step would have been kind of just like having a comedic moment and saying, well, she's going to remain rich, but he really followed through with like the impact of the storyline. She's lost her fortune and she's kicked out of the huge mansion she was living in. And Nagi herself kind of makes fun of the fact that they could have taken the easy road. At some point she says, well, if I had wanted to keep the fortune, I could have talked to Grandpa and surely convinced him that I could remain the heir to the fortune, but I figured I don't need it anyway.
Right. So as a result of losing, or forfeiting, I suppose, the inheritance, Hayate is sent out to find a new place to live, and he ultimately finds an inn, which, curiously enough, belongs to Klaus, who gets a brief moment of spotlight. That was rather amusing. Just a little bit of Klaus is okay. He finds an inn with a cat spirit, who was the spirit of the cat who belonged to Yukariko, Nagi's mother, and he quells this entire cat spirit situation. This was a little bit of a mini arc unto itself, so I guess I can get your thoughts on it, Clint.
Yeah, just hearing a little backstory on Yukariko, Nagi's mom, was pretty cool, and the cat spirit itself lent itself to some great comedy.
Right. So that spirit now having been tamed or settled, what have you, they finally move in, and the last point at the midway point of this year is that this new apartment's selling point to potential tenants is going to be that it comes with a butler, presumably Hayate. I rather enjoyed that decision plot-wise. What did you think of it?
Yeah, it was well done. It's definitely a good – it was an interesting choice to make the apartment seem better than it is, because it's certainly not a very upscale apartment for the price they're asking.
Mm-hmm. So what was your standout moment of the year to date?
My standout moment was the moment when Hayate saves Athena and he's holding her, but he says that he's going to remain Nagi's butler.
Mine is similar. It is actually that moment when he pulls her out and is holding her. To me, that was the culmination of what was a fantastic arc. Moving on then, Kakkaishi, chapters 289 to 312. I'm going to leave the bulk of this to you, Drew. Let us know what's been going on in Kakkaishi, would you please?
At the beginning of this year, Kakkaishi was wrapping up the whole tag with the Lord inside the Karasumori Castle arc, and Yoshimori ends up managing to coax the Lord out from the castle, and as a result, like, they get the Lord inside of this small spiritual ball, and the castle and the academy itself collapse as a direct result of that. And immediately afterwards, Yoshimori and his mom travel to another temporary residence for him to train and keep the Lord, while in the meanwhile, like, demons naturally come for the Lord's power, which is itself a little bit of a setup arc for what comes up next. At first, he's just fighting ordinary monsters at night, but the second night of being in the new location, like, there is an attack of another monster, one that has the power of doors in a dimensional space. Yoshimori fights it, kind of loses, but it turns out the monster was a pet of who else but the founder, the very first Kakkaishi, Hazuma Tokimori, who just shows up and in a trench coat looking fine and ready to train Yoshimori to seal the Lord once and for all. And in there we get an interesting bit where we find out that Yoshimori is really left-handed, something that Tokimori notices right away when he's trying to use Kekkai seals. So that's an interesting minor training scene. That itself leads us into an arc with the Ogi clan where they are trying to guard their own Shinryuichi against the hunters that are still around, that are less likely to target the Lord now because they're being guarded by both the Founder and Yoshimori. So they are attacked by the Founder of the Urukai. It's a complicated structure of peoples, but the Founder of the Urukai attacks with his power, which is effectively spiritual snakes that go into someone's body and brainwash them entirely. There's no will save against this. It just happens. So he just does that on the entire mountain full of Ogi clan people. Eventually, it's just Ogi Shichiro building a wind barrier around the mountain and not really succeeding. So then Yoshimori comes in, saves Shichiro and the land itself that they're standing on, but at the same time, the Founder makes his escape with about two-thirds of the clan now as brainwashed soldiers, which is a really amazingly impactful chapter. And then, similarly, the Urukai is then right away attacked by the Founder within the next two chapters, and you get this badass display of top-level, totally amazing powers that the top brass and the Urukai have, and then the Founder just drops a blanket of sea snakes on the entire Urukai, and minus Masamori, who has Zekai, the one ability in series that's been shown to be able to counter it, and nothing else has ever even been shown to do that, he's the only one to survive, and that's how Kakashi leaves off, with the Founder both extremely powerful and in control of a spiritual army of some of the strongest people in the world.
Certainly a lot of plot development over this year. I mean, other series might pack more plot into individual chapters, but this one, just the direction, the length of the direction that the story has gone over this entire half of the year is rather surprising, because they're not just changing settings, not just revealing amazing pasts of characters and things like that, but also just the impact of each event is so huge. What do you think that stands out the most to you in this half-year period, then?
There was a lot, but the single most impactful moment has to be the moment when the snakes are dropped on top of the entire Urukai and they just march towards the Founder in lockstep. It's amazing and scary, frankly.
To me, I really liked the entire scene of tag with the Lord, with Yoshimori and Chishinmaru. I just really liked establishing the relationship of those two characters. It might not be the most impactful moment. Certainly the moment that you quoted is by far and away more action-oriented, more serious, dramatically oriented. But I really found it to be a very nice moment to establish the character relationship establishment between Yoshimori and Chishinmaru. So that's what stood out to me. Going to take a look briefly at Gintama for this year, chapters 291 to 314. In Gintama fashion, you had a couple longer arcs and then a bunch of individual episodic comedy chapters. You had the tail end of the Santa comedy arc, which was rather funny. Yamazaki's entire stakeout, where he's been watching over a woman and he's dieting on nothing but Anpan, because that's what he buys day in, day out, because it's cheap, and he eventually goes absolutely crazy and insane in his quoting philosophy on Anpan, just absolutely seeing Yamazaki go nuts like that was hilarious. There was the New Year's cards chapter, decent, again, along with the chocolate delivery chapter, the Catherine marriage chapter. I mean, funny stuff, but not really sizable. And we finally get to the Four Heavenly Kings arc. In the same vein as Hayate, which we mentioned, can turn on a serious switch and flip into that serious mode quite effectively, Gintama does the same thing extremely well. The Four Heavenly Kings arc, quite frankly, is probably my favorite arc in the entirety of Gintama thus far, simply because of the fights themselves, the characterization of the various factions warring against each other, but then some of the factions banding together for the sake of Kabukicho as a whole. Really loved seeing the methods of storytelling used here, the characterization used here, really touching to me. And then ultimately, the midway point of this year cuts us off at the first chapter of the mini-arc with Kamui, Kagura's brother, and the Harusami Space Pirates, which was, if we're looking at it as an ending point for any given period of time, a little bit of a letdown, because that was kind of an awkward mini-arc. But certainly the standout moment to me of this year was the Four Heavenly Kings arc. Really an excellent, excellent arc. Let's take now a look at History's Strongest Disciple, Kenichi, chapters 366 to 389. Clint, would you like to fill us in on what's happened?
Yeah, the particular chapter we start off with is the Elder explaining Eternal Sunset, which is just like the first time it appeared, it was the cause of World War II, is what he says. And immediately after that talk is had by the Masters, we see that Freya's grandfather has been kidnapped by Yomi, the evil organization, who is now seemingly like more active and about. So they kidnap him, and immediately a rescue arc comes after that, so Kenichi and all of his friends decide to go and help Freya and try to rescue her grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Drew, what did you think of this entire series of events?
It seemed like it was obvious foreshadowing for what's going to become a larger clash later.
What took place right after that, then, Clint?
Well, at the end of that arc, kind of as a guard over the staff user, they introduced a guard, Jumsai, which is the great rival that we had been hearing of from Apachai, who he didn't think he could beat, and he was saying all that things like, it's a master's place to die for his disciple, things you really don't expect to hear out of Apachai. Right following that, we get the announcement that a base for Yomi has been found in Okinawa, so they take the trip there, and you know that it's going to come to a clash between Apachai and a guard Jumsai.
What are you talking about? They're just on vacation.
Yes, of course. Can't read too heavily into that. We have some notes here on some fan service. Is there fan service in Kenichi, Clint?
I think there might be a little bit, if you read between the pages.
Okay. Yeah, that particularly the Freya fan service was the first majorly noticeable incident of it. Did that jump out at you at all, Drew? Figuratively and literally?
Well, yeah, it kind of did, because this was topless with a towel, like barely covering anything. I mean, at least you'd expect like to have the towel wrapped around her waist, but it's not even. It's just like hanging over, blocking off the nipple parts. It's ridiculous.
Then we have some fights beginning, don't we, Clint?
Yeah, we have, as they storm the Okinawa base, we have the Elder versus every soldier on the base, which is pretty funny as he's like Hadoukening people with his ki and things like that. And then the real fights start as they penetrate deeper into the base with Shigure facing off against the knight, the mounted knight on the horse, the Black Knight.
Right, which ultimately does tend to end up being more fan service, unfortunately. I mean, did you have any positives to take away from this, Drew?
Well, the only positive I had was just how well the initial setup of the fights was done. Every master gets an opponent with at least some personality, and you are left looking forward to it, though Shigure's fight was ultimately a letdown. Mm-hmm. The others, which came later, perhaps not so much, but
so
yeah,
the
Shigure fight itself was a very big letdown fan service chapter.
Right. So then, moment of the year so far, Clint?
For me, it was after the spear user arc, when the Masters had openly like criticized Kenichi for putting his life on the line against a Master Cross fighter, and then when they didn't think he was there to listen, but he actually was, they were praising him and talking about like how much he'd grown and how proud of him they were.
What did you notice most, Drew?
For me, it was the moment when they're about to bust into the military base. It's like, don't worry, we've got a plan to avoid like the worst possible situation. And then like the Elder busts in through the front gate while wearing the Garu X mask.
For me, it was the fight on the truck where Kenichi finally shows some resolve to go after someone who is pretty much at the same level, and then he's also caught up in a fight potentially of someone at a master strength level. Just the angles, you know, the quote-unquote camera angles of that entire fight sequence to me really stood out. Toriko, chapters 78-101, we are still in ice hell at the beginning of the year. And you had some lesser fights, which were still enjoyable, just not quite as important. You had the fight between Takemaru and Boyuz. You had the fight between Match and Barry. But really, what stands out most here is obviously the fight between Toriko and Tomirad. What did you think about this fight overall, Drew?
It was very, again, it gives you a very good sense of scale. It's just one-on-one in ice, but it does a very good job of showing you how people would practically fight in a freezing environment, with some ridiculous powers mixed in. Like, Toriko has to wear his wetsuit the entire time or he's going to freeze to death. Mm-hmm. And in order to avoid that, he just, through gourmet cells, he's able to shiver really fast to keep himself warm. And Tomirad himself is more just overpowered, so he's able to avoid that. But his bugs themselves are very interesting to witness fight. And you see Toriko unveiling some new powers, trying his best to win, but ultimately he loses and he gets pretty well beat up for it.
Right, that was a really shocking ending. Really tasteful, though. Really well done. In that, you know, it's not enjoyable to always have your protagonist win. This was a very, very well done. An excellent fashion in which to end this fight, which then ultimately ends this series of fights. The focus then moved to the Century Soup, which obviously was the entire point of the entire Ice Hell arc, which turns out to be depleted at this point. And you see a little bit more of Teppei, who is a Saisaya, who is there to protect the ingredients of the world. He has some moments of fighting magic, if you will.
Some moments of trying to avoid, like, mentioning that the soup is gone, because that destroys their lifeline.
Yes, of course.
And then, in the process of stopping someone from mentioning that the soup is gone, he stops them and then says, "Ooh, good thing, now they won't know that the soup is gone."
Yes, excellent comedy there. So then, before anyone is able to leave Ice Hell, you have the emergence of Alfaro, who is the waiter of this grand nefarious evil character that we don't know too much about. But Setsuna comes in, saves the day, is able to not only allow the entire main cast to make their safe escape, but also puts Alfaro back in his place. In order to heal Toriko's arm, he's going to be taken to the Country of Life.
In the fight between Toriko and Tommy Rod, he loses his arm.
Right. So then in an attempt to regrow that arm, he has to be taken to the Country of Life, which evidently has the medicine or methods with which to do this. All the while, Komatsu is going to attempt to recreate the Century Soup. So you have a couple different camps of action going on here. In the Country of Life, we are introduced to Yosaku, who is going to be the person to enable Toriko to regrow this arm by some bizarre method involving literally regrowing it. And then Komatsu, along with the baby wall penguin that he brought back from Ice Hill, makes a very shocking discovery as to the final secret ingredient of this century soup, doesn't he, Drew?
He makes an absolutely shocking discovery. While making a nearly complete century soup, he feeds it to the penguin, and the penguin, in his haste to eat it, is drooling. That drool drips into the century soup, thereby completing it.
Just a fantastic concept, first of all. It's such a novel idea. But the panel, that one panel where the drop of drool falls in the soup and that aurora appears over the soup as it did for the original Century Soup. Fantastic, fantastic panel. Also fantastic when Komatsu finally does complete this soup and gathers everyone over after Toriko's regrown his arm to try out the soup. The reaction faces were really priceless. Just the melting of their faces into bizarre, obscene, nearly, smiles. Very funny moment. But some serious note, as a result of Komatsu completing the soup, his hotel is raised from a 5-star rating to a 6-star rating. I believe that you liked that, didn't you?
Yeah, it shows good progression of Komatsu as a character. Certainly one of the biggest strengths of Toriko as a manga is that Komatsu, who is a totally useless fighting character in a fighting-oriented series, can still be useful because it's also a food-oriented series, and he's a chef.
Yeah, and then ultimately, Toriko is met face-to-face with Ichiryu, and this begins a training arc, presumably, for Toriko. This is kind of the last piece of action that we have in this year. Brief thoughts on Ichiryu and Toriko training?
Well, it certainly is nice to see that there are still people above Toriko on the good side of things in this world, because it's clear there are a lot of villains that are also above him.
Right.
And the training will certainly help him fight on equal terms with them.
Highlight of the year, then, Drew?
Penguin drool.
Well put. For me, it was the entirety of the Toriko and Tommy Ride fight, which is still, in my mind, the best fight in any manga of the year so far. Excellently done. Gamaran, the Samurai series, chapters 31 through 54. Clint, at the beginning of this, Gama meets up with some fighters from the same school, does he not?
Yeah, he meets up with guys back from his school that he learned. Specifically, two fighters that are kind of like comrades with him, and then a mentor-type character.
Mm-hmm. And then there's some fights that take place right after this. There's a person who throws needles kind of in a paralyzing manner, and then there's a character who uses a weapon that is a combination of a scythe and a weight attached to a chain at the end of it, if I recall correctly. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. That was an interesting series of fights. He was first outclassed, but then he went on to beat the needle user in fantastic fashion, by the way.
Yes.
He defeated the needle user. And the scythe user used that as a distraction to escape.
So then ultimately we're left with the aftermath of that leading into a training arc. I mean, is there much to say on a training arc?
Yeah, I mean, he's just getting stronger because he got beat up way too much in the fight between the two fighters previously.
And that finally brings us to the challenge against the Spear School, the Four Heavenly Spears, ultimately. And the winner of this series of fights is going to get them to meet the Thousand Master, Kurigane Jinsuke, Gama's father. So obviously there's even more incentive than usual to win a fight for Gama. Of the action that we've been able to see so far in this half year between the Ogame School and the Four Heavenly Spears, what did you think of that?
It was a pretty cool arc. I definitely think the moment that stood out to me the most from this year was when Gama fought the huge spear wielder, the guy that just was like muscled and had the gigantic spear, and he beat him, and the guy like finished with his dying pose as like holding the spear at the ready.
Right. That was your highlight of the year then?
Yeah.
For me, rather shamelessly, it's Gama cutting a guy in half. I honestly, that was just so overwhelmingly brutal. And kind of out of nowhere, that it still is the thing that stands out to me the most about this series. The World God Only Knows, chapters 81 through 104. I believe, Drew, you did most of the research on this, so could you fill us in on the plot?
Well, I can fill you in on the plot. I cannot fill you in on the names.
Fair enough. I don't think anyone can.
Yeah, well, chapter 81 of The World God Only Knows starts us off with the first major arc, which is the arc where he swaps bodies and lives with the rich girl. He runs into a girl by accident, which is typical of this series formula, and who is rich and under financial familial restrictions over like her behavior conduct, and that means she has to leave a band she really wants to do. So they end up swapping bodies through the demon magic of the demon that's possessing her. While they switch lives, Kama gets addicted to otome games, which are basically games for girls where you fall in love with bitches, and he uses that eventually to solve the problem of them being swapped and him being a girl now who has to win over a guy. And in the meantime, the girl in the guy's body joins the band that Ayumi and the others have created in another plot point, and she ends up being the drummer for that. Once Kama eventually solves the problem in typical Kama fashion, the girl rejoins the band as herself, as a girl, but wearing a boy's uniform. Showing an interesting character growth there.
So that kind of summarizes an arc as a whole there. Clint, what did you think about that arc?
It was a pretty decent arc. I was pretty amused with the fact that he like got body swapped and then had to, as a girl, capture his own body.
Yeah, I rather enjoyed that one too. One of the better recent arcs of this series. Maybe not one of the best arcs of the entire series, but I mean, considering, admittedly, I do kind of have a storyline / genre bias against body swapping, and I found this to be largely very enjoyable. Speaks towards the quality of it as a whole. Any actual opinionated thoughts on what happened in this one, Drew?
I enjoyed it. There were certainly a lot of great comedy moments and some interesting moments where it's like, the prince and the pauper, you switch places for a day, you get more freedom, but ultimately you want to go back. That's kind of what it was like, and it was enjoyable enough. The comedy was the highlight for me.
Mm-hmm. Then that began an arc involving sibling rivalry, sibling relations between people at a dojo. Would you like to fill us in on that one then, Drew?
Well, this one, Kama joins the dojo he used to go to again in order to get the spirit out of another sister. The older sister of the karate girl we met a long time ago. The younger sister remembers some aspects of their relationship, but not the final date, so Kama eliminates her from the possibility of may contain goddess out of the girl he's already captured. Meanwhile, the older sister is revealed to have issues with always being looked up to, always being the bigger sister. And because she's always the bigger sister, she has to be better. She becomes increasingly giant because of the spirit inside of her. And eventually, she just becomes ridiculously, ridiculously giant and visible to everyone. So eventually, her sister and Kama head into the belly of the giant sister, fight with her dark spirit emotions, and eventually solve the problem. But that's not so much Kama's fault, which is abnormal for a World God Only Knows arc.
And then ultimately, I think what the way that this actually was ended up to be resolved is that this Weiss was forced out. This huge demon spirit was forced out of the body of the older sister, And for once, at least thus far in the story, it wasn't Kama or Elsie who actually took care of the spirit. And it's at the end of this little arc, it was actually that sadist teacher, which I found to be particularly interesting. Thoughts then on this mini arc as a whole? It wasn't really as much of a focus on Kama as it was the relationship between the sisters. Were you okay with that, Drew?
I was okay with that. Kama's still far and away the best character of the series, but it was an interesting change of perspective to see it focus on, like, a conflict between two side characters, ultimately. I think they pulled it off well enough. It wasn't the best, though.
What did you think about it, Clint?
It was pretty entertaining, and whenever I can get a story arc centering around a giant girl, you know.
Of course.
Pretty good time.
Does that meet your giant girl fetish then, apparently?
Yes.
Great.
I'm sure it was drawn with that in mind.
Of course. specifically for Clint. And then very briefly after this, there was a short date with Elsie, a mini arc chapter, etc., where they go to an amusement park where Kama wants to cheer up Elsie, who was apparently down, feeling down. And so he seeks the help of some classmates, finding out what it is that she would like for him to do for her, and that is to go out on a pseudo-date. Fill us in on some more of the details of this, Drew, and then give us your thoughts on it.
Well, simply put, they go to the amusement park and she's not really entertained. They go to the fire station and she sees real fire trucks. And what a moment. For Elsie to be obsessed with fire trucks in the first place is a great character trait, isn't it, Clint?
Yeah, it's hilarious every time we see it. And it's also kind of endearing, the way she gets, like, super excited and emotional whenever she sees fire trucks.
That is one of my favorite character traits in any series, comedy or otherwise. Just a brilliant little touch. And you never would have thought of something like that prior to this. Really well done. The date with Elsie was certainly far less important in comparison to the other two arcs that we talked about, but it was still fairly enjoyable. So, Clint, what did you think of World God Only Knows this year so far?
My favorite moment was him showing Elsie the fire trucks, like her expression and her reaction to seeing the fire trucks. Like, can I go up next to them? Can I get close? Can I touch them? It was pretty good.
True.
For me, it was the moment when Kama, as a girl, has started to get into Otome games, and he's just using capturing God mode on them, playing six of them at once.
Yeah, that was pretty damn funny, actually. To me, it was actually something a little bit more serious than either of you. It was the moment when Kama realized that, yes, admittedly, it was in the middle of a bunch of comedy when he's playing all these Otome games, but it was the moment when he realized that he can't go on doing this because the girl is becoming satisfied with the body swap. I thought that was an interesting moment in time. I'm going to take a look then at Hunter x Hunter, which... it's back on hiatus again, but there were some chapters this year, 291 to 310, the beginning of which saw us in the middle of the fight between Netero and the King, which saw some ridiculous Nen powers. I mean, if you originally got into the series because of all the different powers, the Nen, that was being used, you probably loved this fight, even if the entire Chimera Ant arc was not up to snuff, and even if the King is just a blatant ripoff of Cell, this was a pretty damn good series of powers revealed in this fight. There were other minor fights, like the one between Killua and Palm, when Palm is revealed to have undergone some kind of weird mutation experiment, etc., at the hands of the ants. The fight between Ikaruga and Werefin, two of the characters that I care least about in any manga ever. Really, the first major moment this year was the revelation that Kaito is dead and has been for some time. So everything that Gon has been doing with the condition of reviving or saving Kaito is completely for naught, completely useless, which leads directly into the fight between Gon and Pito, where Gon just freaks out, goes insane, uses up so much of his Nen that he actually physically ages, grows to a teenage or a young adult level, and he's just rippling muscles, revealed with very peculiar camera angles, I might add. But Gon just absolutely brutally destroys Pito, and that was so satisfying. After so long for Gon to have been marginalized and minimized in importance as a character, for him to just come out, get a ridiculous power-up, and just destroy Pito, well worth the wait. There was a little bit of development after this. The King takes out both Meleoron and Knuckle, and then he kind of puts this game restriction on himself where he's only going to use his N a couple more times or something like that. I mean, that was kind of silly afterwards. But really, the standout moment of the year with regards to Hunter x Hunter is the moment when Gon basically goes Super Saiyan. He just goes absolutely insane, ages, and freaks out and kills Pito. Great moment. Maho Sensei Negima, chapters 275 to 294. Clint, would you like to fill us in on this, please?
So where we start off is the ballroom party, and it's attacked by Cosmo and Telekea, and Negi and party realize that they're going to have to go confront fate right now, so they're trying to get away from the party and escape from the magic world people so they can go do that, and right in the middle of it is kind of this fight going on between Jack Rackin and fate. I think you were interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, to me that was such an epic fight where he's just, he being Jack Rackin, of course, is just breaking out all this, these gargantuan, gigantic, humongous weapons and just colossal magic weaponry and spells. Just the scale of this fight was just massive and thoroughly enjoyable between two characters who, you know, one of which, Fate, is revealed to be hugely important to the story, and the other one, Jack Rackin, who is just a blast to read about. I mean, what did you think of this fight, Drew?
I was extremely impressed. I think, out of all the fights in Negima, just for sheer epic scale of it, and for sheer amazement, badass, you can't beat Jack Rackin. In fact, you shouldn't be able to beat Jack Rackin at all, which is sort of my beef with the end of this fight.
Right. At least he would certainly not have you believe that he can be beaten because he is at the top of his own tier list.
Yeah.
Go ahead and proceed with the plot summary, if you would, Clint.
So the fight wraps up and Rackin gets wiped off the face of existence, like the rest of what's been happening to the people from Magic World, and fate disappears. So Negi and them follow them, and that proceeds in the longest ship ride I've ever seen in order to capacitate the training arc that takes place in the scroll they got from Eva, which is used for a training arc. Negia trying to learn how to control Meiji Arebia, which is slowly like consuming him from the inside out with darkness.
Right. That training arc was actually rather good, I thought. I mean, yes, there were some comedic moments during this entire time period, the time when Eva is actually summoned, and she's found to be naked on a couch playing Nintendo on an old crappy TV, which was a particularly funny moment. Why was she naked? But I suppose why not? But then the training arc itself, the battles were really well drawn. The action was good. And he was learning, Negi, was learning to rely on the people around him. Did you find anything particularly of note in this, Drew?
I was moderately interested. The big thing was just like the new string of Pactios that they did.
Right. That had been a long time coming, wouldn't you say, Clint?
Yeah, we had been waiting to see these girls finally basically make out with a 13-year-old. It had been on all of our minds, I think, for a while.
Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, I believe, after this training is completed, they take off to go, you know, after Fate. What happens en route there?
So they come out of the scroll, and they're back on their way to get to Fate, and they now have the bulk of the military of the magical world behind them, who are kind of like fighting to clear paths and clear the way of demons. So they... you know, they find the point through the barrier that they have to cross through, and they're going over their war plan while they're doing it. And what they realize is that they're going to need to fight their way through, like, multiple levels of bosses when they get to this place. And it's all kind of very reminiscent of plot lines you may have seen in the past. I think Drew especially liked that part of it.
It's definitely a nice little mockery of cliche. Like, we know that enemies are going to be set up with this particular order, and then they sort of have a little more fun with it once they actually get to the temple or enemy stronghold, as it were.
Right. And ultimately, you know, they do arrive there, and they're making their way in. Just as they've landed, they come across a character that one of us has been... They've had their eye looking out for this one character for the beginning of the series, was it?
Yeah. Basically, since the class roster, I've been trying to find Zazie Rainy Day. And she finally shows up in this chapter for, like, the first time that we've ever seen her, really. I mean, we saw her briefly in the school festival when she was doing the Nightmare Carnival, which I would have loved to have seen, but got passed up, obviously, for the impact of this moment when she's just standing there when they show up.
So then your highlight of the year would be?
Zazie.
Fairly self-explanatory. What about you, Joe?
My highlight of the year is almost the Jack Bracken fight, but I'm still so mad about the way it ended. My big highlight is the part where they're talking about like how the bosses are going to be set up before they actually go into the stronghold. Them just hanging a terrific lampshade all over it.
Right. For me, it actually was the Jack Bracken fight. Just blew me away with just the huge sheer scale of the entire thing. Let's take a look now at Siren, chapters 101 to 124. Let's look at Siren while we still can. What happens at the beginning of the year then, Drew?
The beginning of the year where they're still stuck fighting the Candyman, that's the guy with the power over bugs and poison gas. And Agiha, of course, unveils new forms to Melxie's door, the one where he spins rings around him and basically creates an absolute defense. But Candyman is killed, ultimately defeated, but he's also able to destroy the terminal that they were originally after that would have killed Moroku in the past. So they're right back to square one, and then they get the call and get sent back to the future again. They go back to a new future where the kids are still at the root. That hasn't changed, but there's also a group of about 500 survivors actually living as a community there, which I thought was a real nice touch just for like all the things Agiha's done in the latest trip to the present.
Right. To me, this was a trip to Siren that I had been looking forward to for an extremely long time, and right off the bat, even seeing something like that you mentioned with the survivors, to see the way that the future had been altered was already satisfying to me. Did you feel it all the same way?
It was interesting. Certainly seeing Agiha's sister show up and remember him from last time, even though he didn't, was an interesting little take on how Siren likes to screw with its own space-time continuum.
Mm-hmm. So then the wise, you know, begin their attack at this point. The first major fight that breaks off here is the Shell versus Vigo fight, which was, I found to be rather excellent. What did you think of this?
I thought it was a good action fight, certainly. You saw someone with an anti-psychic ability in general strength going up against the guy with the ability to phase through walls and have weird body parts and stuff. It was...
I don't believe he had just any anti-psychic ability. Am I correct?
Yeah, he had the anti-psychic yin-yang shake-up, which is a cool name for a technique in the first place. Why don't people use shake-up more? I don't know. They should. Zhao does. Follow Zhao.
So Zhao, not the only character to be involved in a fight. Certainly not the most awesome character, overwhelmingly cool character to be involved in a fight. Kyle takes on 5 invading wise members in a rather excellent series of fights there, kind of one amalgam of fights. And he's not really losing, at least at the point where you first see him, is he?
At the point where you see him, he's a little hard on breath. He's a little bit scratched up, but he's not losing. And he eventually ends up in a one-on. He fights them all while in the air, taking on multiple ones in one jump. Ultimately, some of them do end up getting past him, but he manages to get in one-on-one with their leader, who is a wise elite.
Mm-hmm. We then see Kabuto again for the first time in God knows how long, and he shows off his newfound powers, which was the ability to catch the death, which, combined with his stand, you know, for lack of a better describing term, makes him a pretty serious strong contender in this entire universe, wouldn't you say?
It makes him pretty much, anything else you learn about it basically brings him down in strength, because right now he just sort of, no matter what technique is thrown at him, he just catches the concept of the death it could cause and turns it back into them to kill them. So if you can be killed by your own strongest technique, he can kill you. And plus he can see the future and dodge pretty much anything. So
that's what I love about this power, is that, oh, by the way, he can see the future. That's become an afterthought at this point. There's some chemistry between Kabuto and Frederica, which was hinted at a little bit. And you get a little bit of some hints as to the relationship between Agiha and Amamiya, which is never entirely touched upon, at least in the first half of this year, let's say. But then finally, this entire little section of an arc here with the wise invading is brought nearly to a conclusion with the arrival of Junis and a new type of Tavu, who just, they come down and pretty much start laying waste to everything, don't they?
Yeah, they take on. Junis starts by taking on Agiha and Zhao 2-on-2, and that fight ends with Zhao splattered against his own blood on the wall. Meanwhile, the new Tavu just, like, goes past all the defenders, like, gets into the citizens who are living in this underground community now as a result of changing the future, and it just eats them all. And we originally thought it killed them. It ended up only being to take them captive, but still a very impactful scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, who comes to save the day? But surprisingly, Ageha's father, Asuka, who comes in with these Nova powers, which had not at this point yet been completely explained, and pretty much handily beats Junis at this point. What'd you think of this appearance of Ageha's father?
It's interesting, and the fact that we've seen him in the past makes it not entirely unexpected that we would have seen him in the future, but it's a little bit of a surprise, and in a manga that deals in surprises very strongly each trip to the future, it's not too out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm. Now, while Asuka may have had some success against Junis, the entire arc is not resolved in a positive fashion. Ultimately, many citizens are captured, and, you know, perhaps more importantly, Marie is captured, which sets off the entire concept of a rescue arc. So we had some other friends coming back into to the fold here. Hiryu shows up again with sun power, effectively. And then kind of the closing scene for this half year is the death of Tenjuin Elmore. So we have a lot of different things going on right now. We have the death of Tenjuin Elmore. We have Marie being captured and the concept of the rescue arc that is forthcoming, and the concept that, you know, ultimately a lot of these characters kind of got beat down, so there may have to be a training arc in the near future from this time period. What are your thoughts on where things go from here, how satisfied you are with the way that concluded?
I'm satisfied with the way at least the raid arc concluded. Certainly the scene where the new type Tavu is going rampaging within the regular citizens, taking them within its belly, was just extremely impactful to me and probably my moment of the series for now.
Okay. My moment of the series for now was just seeing the new powers revealed during the Wise Invasion, very specifically looking at Kabuto's power-up. I thought that was the most interesting. Granted, a little bit broken the way that we saw it, but still rather interesting. I'm going to take a look now at Dead Man Wonderland, chapters 31 to 36. It is, of course, a monthly series. Clint?
Okay, so it starts off, and Ganta's been captured by the director of the prison. And the first chapter we're looking at, Shiro and Azuki break in, and they're both there to rescue him, and he's, of course, shocked at it. So they're making their escape. And while this is going on, the previous captain of the guard has called in her friends from back in her fighting days, and they're seeking to take over the prison because they're fighting back against this corrupt director who's been running things into the ground at the prison and making all the dead men fight each other. So we get to see a series of fights as Ganta is trying to escape. Ganta, Shiro, and Azuki are trying to escape, and they're kind of helped along by the friends Ganta's made inside the prison, and we get some backstory for each of those characters. The fights are generally acceptable and pretty good, and it ends with, of course, Ganta's face-off against the leader of Squad 1 of the Forgery Deadmen, who they've been fighting against this entire time. And he ends on what is my favorite part of the series. Him and Shiro join hands, and he kind of finally tells her that he's in love with her, and then he fires a bullet at the boss that is just beyond anything we've seen so far, and defeats him, and that's where we're leaving off.
Taking a look now at D. Greyman, chapters 191 to 195, I have no idea what's going on. It's something to do with Alma and Kanda, and Alan's kind of there, and the Millennium Earl's kind of watching alongside, and Alan, being the 14th, is being beckoned to join the Earl, and he's almost looking like he's going to agree to this deal, but we don't know. And there's random characters on the sides of the action saying things like, oh, so it's begun. You know, completely unknown characters as to now. Who knows what the hell's begun? I have no idea what's going on anymore. Since this series became monthly, I just can't even tell you what the hell's going on whatsoever. So my highlight of the year-to-date is... there's probably like a good like sword slash or two. I don't know what's going on anymore. So, Clint, save us. Soul Eater, 70 to 75.
Soul Eater, where we're starting off here, 70, is just about to go into the Book of Avon, which they're going in there to save Death the Kid, who's been trapped by Noah. So they go in and they figure out, they're told by the Table of Contents, who has materialized in a character, that they need to work their way through all the chapters of the book if they're going to find Kid, who is at the very bottom of the book in the last chapter. So they go originally into the chapter of Lust, which is its little trick is that all of their genders are reversed, and they'll slowly be unreversed as they work farther into the book and work off Lust, which is, I guess, a sin that stays with you. and it's revealed to them that the last character to have their gender swapped is the most sexually promiscuous character among them. So they're all hoping that they're not going to be the last person to change back. They move then into the chapter of gluttony, which there's a big giant pig and they're all eating and the pig chef is trying to kill them. So they cut up the pig and they eat him. It's all kind of wacky and crazy and exactly what you want to see out of Soul Eater. While all this is going on, Kid is sitting down there at the very bottom of the book and he's met up with like an elder power who is telling him secrets of pure symmetry, which is what Kid has been after. And so that's going on in the background. Maka and Soul jump forward a few chapters past their friends who are advancing normally. Maka and Soul seem to advance up a couple chapters. And these chapters kind of give them doubts as to each other. And Maka doubts that she is good enough to keep up with Soul. And Soul doubts that Maka is the right master for him and that he just picked her because he wanted someone who didn't understand music. Because he kind of feels inferior to his brother because of his music. So that's going on, and then we get a quick cutback at the very last chapter we're talking about to Kid, who has just completely like changed his appearance and gotten darker. And he says, "Now I get to test my new power out." And he's about to face off with one of the very people who came into the book to rescue him, Blackstar. My defining moment of this series is when they first go into the book and they're in the chapter of Lust, and all of their genders are swapped. It's just hilarious comedy.
Okay, Zettai Kaden Children, chapters 200 through 222. Would you like to explain to us what has been happening thus far, Drew?
Well, ZK3C went through a couple of arcs this year. It's a series that goes itself by arc titles, so it's easy to split them up. The beginning of this year was the ending of the mysterious transfer students arc, which is Kaoru and the children breaking up a fight between Kagari and delinquents. He's about to use his power, but he's stopped by Tono, who just ends up getting beaten up himself. And because they get beat up themselves, Patty, the Fujoshi member of the villain crew, starts shipping them as a gay couple. And then after that, we move immediately into the Catwalker arc, which is Nai, this pet of Yuri, Feather, Black Phantom daughter, whatever you want to call her, has had a plastic explosive surgically implanted in her brain so that she can't be saved the same way Tim and Bullet and Patty were earlier on in the series. So she fights the children. They fight her not knowing that. Yuri manages to save her. And as a result of all this storylines, like everything that happens, Feather is caught and Babel now has her under holding custody. Then we go through a completely unnecessary comedy arc where Minamoto and Sakaki are stranded in the jungle and absolutely nothing at all happens. So we can really skip that part. That's called Lost Guys, for the record. After that, we go into the Toy Soldiers arc where we get into the implications of Feather being held captive. Tim, the toy-based Esper power user, is trying to create a body for Feather, who's now captive, but he goes with Mio and the others because Kugutsu, who is an extremely respected doll maker and a former member of Babel in his own right, is extremely good at those things. They end up getting captured by the normal people and saved subsequently by the children in Minamoto. The children, again, stop Pandora Kids from going too far when they take their revenge against the normal people. There's a brief moment there. And at the end of the arc, what I found to be very interesting is that Kagutsu, who was a very early on villain of the series, he's talking to Sakaki. He's leaving behind the body materials for Feather. He says, "Yeah, I'm sorry that I did all these things to you guys earlier on. I was just sort of angry because I thought I wasn't being accepted. But I guess those things are the social norms wherever you go, and that's just not going to change." And I thought that was a great showing of growth from what has been up to this point a fairly minor and joke character. And the last arc to close out this half of the year was the My Wings arc, which starts with Hyobu staring at the prediction machine, hoping for the future to change. Meanwhile, Kaoru's struggling over the fact that Minamoto chose to move out earlier on in the story, and she's still in denial. She kind of breaks down a door between her and his room. And in the meanwhile, there's an earthquake, and an island is in trouble, and they have to go rescue it from a natural disaster. And in the process of all that, Minamoto orders Kaoru to help the people of the island first over him if he should happen to get injured. And naturally, as you would expect, he does. And Kaoru shows a surprising display of maturity there. John, you had something to say about that?
Yeah, just to me, I found it really enjoyable the way that she did actually focus on quote-unquote the right thing and going after the general populace of the island, the general makeup of the island first, rather than doing what her heart might dictate, and that is going after Minamoto. Kaoru, you know, certainly has been growing in maturity as a character all along, but, you know, we still do think of her at times as the immature, you know, silly little girl who's only focused on making dirty old man type of jokes. This was really one of the moments that stood out to me in terms of her maturity being really expressed solidly in terms of one actual moment. And that took us right into a Feather basically coming in and kind of just swooping down and saving the day then, didn't she?
Yeah, it sort of solves the morality dilemma when Feather just reconstitutes her body, meanwhile, in Tokyo, and then immediately teleports over to the island in a display of absolutely broken levels of power. She then fishes Minamoto out from under the mud and heals him. So in the end, he's fine enough. He still has minor injuries, but he's able to go on. And then we're treated to the whole scene with Kaoru and Aoi and Shiho, like, making up and hugging Minamoto afterwards, being worried about him. And that almost closes off the arc. There's one last chapter where Kyobu sends a message via Fujiko and explains that the future is being changed as a result of something, which I thought was a very nice wrap-up to that arc in particular, which started with him just staring desperately at the prediction machine.
Mm-hmm. So what was your highlight of this year so far, then?
My highlight of this year was the semi-apology speech by Kugutsu, which was that I was being a bit too harsh towards you guys. I needed to be more conscious of the fact that, like, that's just the way things are and I have to get used to them.
For me, it was, like I mentioned earlier, Kaoru rightfully choosing not to save Minamoto first. I thought that she displayed great maturity there. Going to take a look at a rather down year for a rather great series, Hajime no Ippo, 879 through 899. Almost the entirety of which focused on the Ippo versus Wooly fight. Let's start off. Any positives to take away from this, guys, at all, Clint?
No.
Drew?
Ippo can use his stand now.
Oh god, that's right. I forgot. This was abysmal. Catastrophe.
Gosh.
Crap. Unbelievable.
Yeah, really. Again, you know, we're not going to dwell on this too long because we did cover it very much in the weekly Beamcast. But overall, Hajime no Ippo is a fantastic series that we strongly, strongly recommend that all of you read. You'll breeze through it. Every fight, for the most part, is just absolutely fantastic, technically precise. Characters are interesting, etc., etc. But this was just absolutely pitiful. Wooly as a character was broken. He came out of nowhere. He had no build-up. He had no reason to be the focal point of an entire fight. The fight itself took way too long. Even if he was going to give Ippo trouble, he could have given him trouble in 10 chapters.
It was a full 30 chapters, and he took him to as many rounds, more rounds than Sendo did, which is really a shame, considering the relative amount of build-up between those two characters.
Right. So, any highlight to take away from this year so far, Clint?
Nothing. Nothing in the first half of this year because of the Wooly fight stood out to me as being good or remarkable or anything.
What about you, Drew?
Nothing really stood out to me as good. The one thing that just crystallized the badness of the Wooly fight is the moment when Ippo's sort of spirit box, or his stand, if you will, which I have chosen to call Marumatinum for no particular reason, reaching out and grabbing Wooly out of the air to prevent him from jumping.
The tail end, at the end of this first half of this year, did see the end of the Wooly fight, which, you know, was a glorious moment unto itself. But then shortly thereafter, we saw Itagaki. We saw an entire chapter devoted to Itagaki's jealousy of Ippo. So, if only by default, this is my highlight of the year because everything else was patently terrible. But that should not take away from the fact that that chapter was rather interesting. Let's look now at the entirety of Adago so far, chapters 1 through 26. Just kind of summarize your thoughts on the entire series as a whole, if you would, Drew.
The entire series as a whole, it's a rather interesting police drama / exorcism story. The exorcism story parts of it sort of echo the old spiritual type of shows, Ghost Sweeper Mikami, Ushio and Tora, that kind of thing. The actual cop drama itself is interesting in its own right and focuses around a young upcoming police officer's obligation towards his brother who died for him. And in the course of all this, he has superpowers that he stole from a serial killer. So it's a very interesting premise that delivers a lot of interesting, so far just arc stories. There's hints at an overall plot, but not really anything huge yet. But it definitely delivers its mini arc stories well, so I'm hopeful for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I won't echo what you've said. You're absolutely right. Some things that stood out to me in particular, one, the art. While, you know, at first glance, it does seem as though the art is, you know, a little bit, maybe inferior is the wrong word, but just very much not the shonen norm. It's very different. But I feel as though the art suits the series rather well, because it is a bit of an alternative story also. So it conveys the emotion, the predicaments that Arago himself gets into. The Brionok power, I think that the art style very nicely complements the visual use of the Brionok power. And then the characters. I find the characters to be rather interesting. There's, to me, not really a weak link in the cast at all, from the early description of the relationship between Arago and Yuen, to learning about Ryo and Joe, the doppelganger, Patchman. I mean, really every character, Seth, every single character that has been introduced has a purpose, does not feel out of place, and is really enjoyable. So what would you feel that your highlight of Arago as an entire series so far is, Drew?
The highlight would have to be the moment when in the flashback between Joe and his partner Rupert, where Rupert is going down a tunnel after following the stench, and he just finds a mountain of victims' bodies from the serial killer they're pursuing.
For me, it was the moment at which Patchman and Yuen returned. Patchman returned bringing along a potentially zombified Yuen. You know, details are as yet unclear. To me, that was so powerful, such a big, legitimate shock. The fact that was such a shock really speaks to the storytelling that the author was able to create within only 26 chapters, so a very standout moment to me. Looking now at Nudari Hyon no Mago, chapters 89 through 112, briefly, this picks up where Nura and his Hyakiyako are traveling to Kyoto to try to stop the rebirth of Hagoro Magitsune. And you see a lot of individualized fights. For example, Awashima is caught in the Thousand Gates realm world, you know, however you wish to call that. A really defining moment is when Tsuchiguma, this huge, terrifying demon, shows up and basically just wipes the floor with the good guys. He absolutely decimates Nura himself and kidnaps Sudara, the Yukiona, the ice girl. This obviously, in shonen fashion, leads to a training arc in which Yuki is training Nura. While you also see Hagoromo Gitsune awaiting to give birth, rebirth. You know, that's a bit of a confusing concept. You get to see some more of these individualized fight scenes. Kubinashi just goes absolutely crazy, you know, doubting himself, doubting his own power, realizing, you know what, I don't need to worry about any of this. I just need to kill. And he starts doing so. And then he gets caught up in a fight with him and Kino against Ibaraki Doji, who's one of the servants of Hagoromo Gitsune, which turns out to be a rather excellent fight. Yuta arrives to kind of save the day, she and her siblings of the exorcist family. You get to see even more individualized fights as, all the while, Nuda is in the background training, so we needed to see some exposure for other characters, one of which is Aotabo, who gets a little bit of a flashback as to how he became exactly who he is as he's protecting the Kyo Cross Squad. But finally, we do focus back on Nuda, which is when the series starts to take off again. He finally learns what having a Hyakiyako is all about. He learns to use the fear of the members of his Hyakiyako. He learns that if the people in his Hyakiyako imbue their fear into him, he can then become even stronger, use that fear in a slightly twisted way, kind of become ethereal, almost. It's, you know, very well done artistically and from a storytelling standpoint. Finally, Nura takes off to go fight Tsuchigumo and save Tsurara, who also imbues Nura with her fear, and then this sets off the beginning of the Tsuchigumo fight, you know, round two, as it were, which kind of cuts off the midway point here of the year. So to me, the biggest progressive moment for the entire series so far was Nuta learning how to use that fear from his Hyakkyako, really big standpoint in the development of this series and development of Nuta as a character. Let's look now at GE Good Ending, chapters 18 to 41, which kind of all runs together, so it's going to be very difficult to break down individual plot points. Some of them include Seiji going on the date at the rock festival with Yuki, who sees Toru, who her old boyfriend, which was rather awkward. And then shortly thereafter, we saw the introduction of Onuma, who is now another member of this love triangle, harem, etc. How did you feel about Onuma when she was first introduced, Drew?
When she was first introduced, she was interesting. She was a fairly transparent new love interest, but I wasn't really angry or hostile at her. She just seemed to be an interesting character in her own right, and I was looking forward to see how she developed.
Mm-hmm. Sho-senpai, the original love interest of the entire series, who has ended up dating the person that she originally was in love with, that was the reason why she couldn't date Seiji, her boyfriend is revealed to have been cheating, and so there's a scene where Seiji confronts the boyfriend, you know, kind of not really his place to do so, but he stands up for this friend of his who has been spurned. Meanwhile, Onuma is in a rather bizarre predicament where her friends are all really egging her on to use her bodily assets, let's say, to have her way with Seiji, because she's revealed to have a crush on Seiji at this point. Any thoughts on either of those two developments?
Well, to me, the date itself was an interesting one. The whole, like, use your sex appeal, not so much. Mm-hmm. It's a very bad plot device, especially for a series that is normally serious about romance like Good Ending is.
Right. Ultimately, there is a sports festival that takes place, and to heighten the sense of drama and a serious sense of a relationship between Seiji and Yuki, Seiji actually kisses Yuki, which is a rather bold move and a rather important move in the grand scheme of this series, wouldn't you say?
Especially given when it happens. He basically steals it from her right after she wakes up. So that sort of lends an interesting atmosphere to the panels where the kiss is drawn. It's definitely a very artfully done one.
Absolutely. And we go from a very artistically meaningful scene to a rather disappointing scene, really, where Onuma not only makes her move, but really forces herself all over Seiji. She, you know, they're at their store where they work, and the lights go out, and she collapses on top of him and is about to reach for his pants. I mean, literally, that's not... I'm not saying that figuratively. She actually reaches for his pants before they're ultimately broken up. And as if that wasn't bad enough in storytelling narrative terms, the next day when Yuki and Seiji are walking by a locker room, they overhear Sho-senpai now admit her love to Seiji, or for Seiji, pardon me. So a couple major steps back, wouldn't you say?
I think, like, the past couple of chapters of Good Ending, after the kiss, have been bit of a step back, a little bit more traditional, a little more derivative, a little less of an interesting romance and more of an uninteresting love triangle / quadrangle.
And then the midway point of the year is reached with Sho actually confronting Seiji, asking if he is in love with Yuki. And as of yet, at this point in time in the plot, she does not have an answer. So then, standout moment of the year to you?
The Sports Fest kiss, no question.
I'd have to completely agree with you there. Another romance series, Kimi no Irumachi 74 through 95. I'm going to breeze through this one, really. Kanzaki is, at the very beginning of this year, does like Haruto after all, doesn't want him to go off to Tokyo, you know, realizes that she spurned her own chance and wants to get back in this. But he does pretty much put her in her place, not negatively, but just decides that he is going to go off and chase after Eba. He leaves for Tokyo, kind of pseudo-awkwardly makes a bunch of new friends. Where this series starts to unravel is the fact that he just takes so damn long to actually find Eba. He doesn't really do it whatsoever. He accidentally commits to a date in Grand Shonen tradition, and of course Eba finally sees him then. They finally meet up, and Eba is revealed to actually have a boyfriend, which was a big question mark. Kazuma, one of his new friends, cheers him up, And then it's also revealed that Kazuma is dying, and then it's furthermore revealed that Kazuma is the boyfriend of Aba, which is a grand twist unto itself, which just sets up a whole string of really, really awkward scenarios. But to me, what stood out the most is the fact that Aba actually did have a boyfriend all along. It wasn't just a ruse. Let's briefly examine the entirety of Lock On, which will someday be completely forgotten as a series, but for an 18-chapter series, anything of particular note stand out to you in an otherwise uneventful and an unimaginative series?
Certainly Lock On was sort of the baby dropped on its head of Shonen to be born and die this year, but the moment when I did enjoy out of the series was the moment where a guy basically commits, like, takes nude pictures of one of the protagonist females, and then the protagonist catches him by observing who's looking at the crowd reaction to those photos, not just the photos themselves, and he catches the sort of the pervert that way.
For me, it was Sanada's flashback of the girl that he exchanged communication with when he was a kid. Overall, the series just really did not speak to me whatsoever, but that was actually rather a great moment of quality in an otherwise barren landscape of mediocrity. Cross Game ended this year, so actually I'm going to change things up from our little script here, and I'm not going to actually reveal technically what my point of the entire year and frankly the entire series was, because it is so absolutely fantastic that I want all of you who are listening to go out and read it and be as blown away by the ending as I was. But I will say that my standout moment of the series thus far is the last page, and very specifically the last panel of chapter 158, the revelation that is made there, which turns out to be the culmination of an entire brilliant, brilliant series. Any thoughts on that also, Clint?
Yeah, just the exact page, the exact panel you mentioned is just so incredible and such a great end to the series that it can't be overlooked. You have to read this series.
Mirai Nikki, chapters 49 through 53. Go ahead and take us through that.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that happens this time around. Start off with Yukiteru and Yuno, the pair team left alive, chasing after the extremely fat eighth, and they're confronted by Akise on the way, who defeats Yuno but is unable to kill her. As a result, she comes back and eventually is able to kill him. But meanwhile, Yukiteru, on his way to kill the eighth, is just killing off his friends one by one, slowly undergoing a transformation completely from, like, anti-hero protagonist to outright villain. Clint, do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, it was kind of shocking, but at the same time, we'd been leading up to it. I mean, it was definitely like a scene full of impact.
And then, of course, after that, you see what the series has been leading up to. Another one of those future predictions. Yukiteru and Yuno start living together, and they have a bath together in a oil drum bathtub, and then have their first night together, and that sort of ends up, without spoiling too much about it, with Yukiteru asking her a question and then her taking an axe to him. Of course, he's able to avoid it, and then you learn a couple of interesting things about this Yuno. Clint, you know about that?
Yeah, the Yuno that we currently see is a Yuno who has already won the game and then went back in time to find herself, and she kind of said, "Well, I don't need two of me," and killed her alternate timeline self.
So what were your standout moments of this series, each of you? Clint, I suppose, first?
Obviously, Yuno killing herself.
What about you, Drew?
For me, it was sort of the last step in Yukiteru's character transformation, where he's shooting each of his friends in a montage.
Fullmetal Alchemist ended this year. Chapters 103 through 108 were this year. The beginning of this year saw the Scar and Bradley fight underway, which was really some well-done action, which, you know, appropriately well-done, let's say. There was the grand epic scale of the world-consuming transmutation circle with Father, you know, reaching out to the sky, which was really a bizarre, creepy, legitimately scary moment for this series, which then leads to Father having a new body and being a completely supremely powerful character, so much so that multiple alchemists have to take him on in a grand fight. One brilliant standout moment from this series was Al sacrificing himself for the sake of Ed regaining his entire body and being able to fight at full capacity. Ed then goes on to defeat Pride with the help of Kimblee, very strangely, who still had enough individuality and consciousness to his soul. He wasn't consumed by the mass of souls. Ed then starts absolutely just decimating Father after all the other alchemists have worn him down, ultimately defeating Father, and then, in a really nice way to wrap up the series, sacrificing his own use of alchemy to bring back Al. He made the necessary sacrifice. And as I mentioned in the actual review of the last chapter in Beamcast, really, really found the actual final chapter very, very, really a flawless ending, frankly. Just every storyline, every plotline was wrapped up in a perfect manner. Of one particular note, I liked the tasteful way in which the pairing of Ed and Winry was hinted at. Not really explicitly mentioned, it was just kind of an open-ended ending, and I really enjoyed that. But to me, the biggest standout moment of the year was Ed finally being legitimized as a protagonist as he was fighting Father, because he had taken a back seat, and finally for him to be the guy to take out Father, to take out the Supreme Being, really meant a lot to me. And then finally, let's look at Metallica, chapters 1 through 7. Really very little to talk about here, so we don't have to rate it on the same scale as all the other series, but you know, we see Luca introduced, this character who can mold metals that are, you know, the basis of this entire world. And he wants to become a Menea, and he goes off to take the Menea exam, and it is ultimately revealed that he will be part of a small team, where he is the spearhead, if you will, and then he has help from two other characters he's met along the way, Gato and Shino. Any standout moments, thoughts on the series in general, Clint?
Yeah, it's really early, like I've said multiple times so far. I like to get a series into 20 or so chapters, but certainly the most recent chapters we have seem to be heading in an agreeable direction.
What about you, Drew?
Yeah, for me, the chapter of Metallica that just absolutely is really interesting is the one where Luca just busts out a solenoid against an electrical enemy and shoots a giant bullet into him using the solenoid that his electrical enemy is conducting.
Mm-hmm. And for me, the standout moment of, you know, only seven chapters, admittedly, was the beginning of that exam. Just, it opens up a lot of different possibilities. This series may not end up being very long, given its ratings in the table of contents, but that if it were to go on for a while, that does present some interesting opportunities. So as with any self-respecting retrospective show of any kind, we are going to present awards. And let's just breeze through these, really. Very quickly, each of you give me a series. First of all, Best Comedy Category, Clint.
Hayate no Gotoku.
Drew?
Beelzebub.
And for me, it was Gintama. How about Best Drama, Clint?
Cross Game.
Drew?
Zetai Kaioken Children.
And for me, Bakuman. Best Action, Clint?
One Piece.
Drew?
One Piece.
Me? One Piece. Most Improved Series of the Year, Clint?
Naruto.
What about you, Drew?
Naruto.
And for me, Naruto. Biggest Disappointment of the Year so far, Clint?
Far and Away Ippo.
Drew?
Hajime no Ippo.
For me, it was Fairy Tail, actually. Least promising going forward from this point on for the rest of 2010. Clint?
Bleach.
Drew?
Bleach.
And, yeah, for me, Bleach. Most promising for the remainder of 2010, Clint?
One Piece.
Drew?
Obviously One Piece.
And, again, yes, One Piece. Dark Horse, the series that perhaps not as many people are talking about as should be, that we feel could really make a name for itself the second half of 2010. Clint?
Beelzebub.
Drew?
Ippo.
And for me, it's going to be Nurenhyo no Mago. And then, finally, the Grand Awards. We're going to get five apiece, countdown from 5 to 1, our series of the half year so far. So, Clint, if you would.
My number 5 is Beelzebub. My number 4 is Soul Eater. My number 3 is Cross Game. Number 2 is One Piece. And the number 1 series that I thought did the best this year was Bakuman.
How about you, Drew?
For me, number 5 was Toriko, number 4 was Arago, number 3 was One Piece, number 2 was Zetai Kaioken Children, and number 1 was Kakashi.
And for me, number 5 was Beelzebub, number 4 was the ending to FMA, Fullmetal Alchemist, number 3 was the ending to Cross Game, number 2 was Bakuman, and as is a surprise to absolutely no one on the internet or anywhere else, number 1 is One Piece. We hope that you've enjoyed this entire retrospective episode. Well, surely we will do an entire year-long retrospective at the end of this year. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you on our regularly scheduled Beamcasts. Good night.